Book 4, Part 1 of the Histories by Publius Cornelius Tacitus. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Histories by Publius Cornelius Tacitus, translated by Alfred John Church and William Jackson Brodribb. Book 4, January to November, A.D. 70. Part 1. When Vitellius was dead, the war had indeed come to an end, but peace had not yet to begin. Sword in hand, throughout the capital, the conquerors hunted down the conquered with merciless hatred. The streets were choked with carnage, the squares and temples reeked with blood, for men were massacred everywhere as chance threw them in the way. Soon, as their license increased, they began to search for and drag forth hidden foes. Whenever they saw a man tall and young, they cut him down, making no distinction between soldiers and civilians. But the ferocity, in which the first impulse of hatred can be gratified only by blood, soon passed into the greed of gain. They let nothing be kept secret, nothing be closed. Vitellianists, they pretended, might be thus concealed. Here was the first step to breaking open private houses. Here, if resistance were made, a pretext for slaughter. The most needy of the populace and the most worthless of the slaves could not fail to come forward and betray their wealthy masters. Others were denounced by friends. Everywhere were lamentations and wailings, and all the miseries of a captured city, till the license of the Vitellianists and Othianist soldiery, once so odious, was remembered with regret. The leaders of the party, so energetic in kindling civil strife, were incapable of checking the abuse of victory. In stirring up tumult and strife, the worst man can do the most. But peace and quiet cannot be established without virtue. Domitian had entered into possession of the title and residence of Caesar, but not yet applying himself to business, was playing the part of a son of the throne with debauchery and intrigue. The office of prefect of the Praetorian Guards was held by Arius Varus, but the supreme power was in the hands of Primus Antonius, who carried off money and slaves from the establishment of the emperor, as if they were the spoils of Cremona. The other generals, whose moderation or insignificance had shut them out from the distinction in the war, had accordingly no share in its prizes. The country, terror-stricken and ready to acquiesce in servitude, urgently demanded that Lucius Vitellius, with his cohorts, should be intercepted on his way from Tarracina, and that the last sparks of the war should be trodden out. The cavalry was sent out to Aricia. The main body of the legions halted on this side of Buvelae. Without hesitation, Vitellius surrendered himself and his cohorts to the discretion of the conqueror, and the soldiers threw down their ill-starred arms in rage quite as much as in alarm. The long train of prisoners, closely guarded by armed men, passed through the capital. Not one of them wore the look of a suppliant, sullen and savage. They were unmoved by the shouts and jests of the insulting rabble. A few, who ventured to break away, were overpowered by the force that hemmed them in. The rest were thrown into prison. Not one of them uttered an unworthy word. Even in disaster, the honor of the soldier was preserved. After this, Lucius Vitellius was executed. Equally vicious with his brother, he had yet shown greater vigilance during that brother's reign, and may be said, not so much to have shared his elevation, as to have been dragged down by his fall. About the same time Lucilius Bassus was sent with some light cavalry to establish order in Campania, where the towns were still disturbed, but by mutual animosities, rather than by any spirit of opposition to the new emperor. The sight of the soldiery restored quiet, and the smaller colonies escaped unpunished. At Capua, however, the 3rd Legion was stationed to pass the winter, and the noble families suffered severely. Tarracina, on the other hand, received no relief. So much more inclined are we to requite an injury than an obligation. Gratitude is a burden, while there seems to be a profit in revenge. They were consoled by seeing the slave of Virginius Capito, whom I have mentioned as the betrayer of Tarracina, gibbeted in the very rings of knighthood, the gift of Vitellius, which they had seen him wear. At Rome, the Senate, delighted and full of confident hope, decreed to Vespasian all the honors customarily bestowed on the emperors. And indeed the civil war, which, beginning in Gaul and Spain, and afterwards drawing into the struggle first Germany and then Illyricum, had traversed Egypt, Judea, and Syria, every province and every army, this war, now that the whole earth was, as it were, purged from guilt, seemed to have reached its close. Their alacrity was increased by a letter from Vespasian, written during the continuance of the war. Such indeed was its character at first sight. The writer, however, expressed himself as an emperor, speaking modestly about himself in admirable language about the state. There was no want of deference on the part of the Senate. On the emperor and his son Titus the consulship was bestowed by decree, on Domitian the office of praetor with consular authority. Mucianus had also forwarded to the Senate certain letters which furnished matter for talk. It was said, "Why, if he is a private citizen, does he speak like a public man? In a few days' time he might have said the very same words in his place as a senator." And even the invective against Vitellius comes too late, and is ungenerous, while certainly it is arrogance to the state, and an insult to the emperor, to boast that he had the imperial power in his hands, and had made a present of it to Vespasian. Their dislike, however, was concealed. Their adulation was open enough. In most flattering language they voted a triumph to Mucianus, a triumph for a civil war, though the expedition through the Samarti was the pretext. On Antonius Primus were bestowed the insignia of consular rank, on Arius Varus and Cornelius Fuscus, praetorian honors. Then they remembered the gods. It was determined that the capital should be restored. All these motions Valerius Asiaticus, consul-elect, proposed. Most of the senators signified their assent by their looks, or by raising the hand. But a few, who either held a distinguished rank, or had a practiced talent for flattery, declared their acquiescence in studied speeches. When it came to the turn of Helvidius Priscus, praetor-elect, to vote, he delivered an opinion, full of respect indeed to a worthy emperor, yet wholly free from insincerity, and he was strongly supported by the sympathies of the Senate. To Priscus, indeed, this day was, in an especial manner, the beginning of a great quarrel and great renown. As I have again happened to mention a man of whom I shall often have to speak, the subject seems to demand that I should give a brief account of his life and pursuits and of his fortunes. Helvidius Priscus was a native of the town of Caracina in Italy, and was the son of one Cluvius, who had been a centurion of the first rank. In early youth he devoted his distinguished talents to the loftiest pursuits, not wishing, as do many, to cloak under an imposing name a life of indolence, but to be able to enter upon public life with a spirit fortified against the chances of fortune. He followed those teachers of philosophy who hold nothing to be good but what is honorable, nothing evil but what is base, and who refuse to count either among things good or evil, power, rank, or indeed anything not belonging to the mind. While still holding the quaestorship, he was selected by Pytheas Thrysa to be his son-in-law, and, from the example of his father-in-law, imbibed with peculiar eagerness a love of liberty. As a citizen and as a senator, as a husband, as a son-in-law, as a friend, and in all the relations of life, he was ever the same, despising wealth, steadily tenacious of right, undaunted by danger. There were some who thought him too eager for fame, and indeed the desire of glory is the last infirmity cast off even by the wise. The fall of his father-in-law drove him into exile, but he returned when Galba mounted the throne, and proceeded to impeach Marcellus Epirus, who had been the informer against Thrysa. This retribution, as great as it was just, had divided the Senate into two parties, for if Marcellus fell, a whole army of fellow culprits was struck down. At first there was a fierce struggle, as is proved by the great speeches delivered by both men. But afterwards, as the feelings of Galba were doubtful, and many senators interceded, Priscus dropped the charge, amidst comments varying with the tempers of men, some praising his moderation, others deploring a lack of courage. On the day, however, that the Senate was voting about the imperial dignities of Vespasian, it had been resolved that envoys should be sent to the new emperor. Hence arose a sharp altercation between Helvidius and Epirus. Priscus proposed that they should be chosen by name by the magistrates on oath. Marcellus demanded the ballot, and this had been the opinion expressed by the consul elect. It was the dread of personal humiliation that made Marcellus so earnest, for he feared that, if others were chosen, he should himself appear slighted. From an angry conversation they passed by degrees to long and bitter speeches. Helvidius asked, "Why should Marcellus be so afraid of the judgment of the magistrates? He has wealth and eloquence, which might make him superior to many, were he not oppressed by the consciousness of guilt. The chances of the ballot do not discriminate men's characters. The voting and judgment of the Senate were devised to reach the lives and reputations of individuals. It concerns the interests of the commonwealth. It concerns the honor due to Vespasian, that he should not be met by those whom the Senate counts to be peculiarly blameless, and who may fill the emperor's ears with honorable counsels. Vespasian was the friend of Thrasea, Soranus, and Sextius, and the accusers of these men, though it may not be expedient to punish them, ought not to be paraded before him. By this selection, on the part of the Senate, the emperor will, so to speak, be advised whom he should mark with approval, and from whom he should shrink. There can be no more effectual instrument of good government than good friends. Let Marcellus be satisfied with having urged Nero to destroy so many innocent victims. Let him enjoy the wages of his crimes and his impunity. But let him leave Vespasian to worthier advisers." Marcellus declared, "It is not my opinion that it is assailed. The consul-elect has made a motion in accordance with the old precedents, which directed the use of the ballot in the appointment of envoys in order that there may be no room for intrigue or private animosities. Nothing has happened why customs of long standing should fall into disuse, or why the honor due to the emperor should be turned into an insult to any man. All senators are competent to pay their homage. What we have rather to avoid is this, that a mind unsettled by the novelty of power, and which will keenly watch the very looks and language of all, should be irritated by the obstinacy of certain persons. I do not forget the times in which I have been born, or the former government which our fathers and grandfathers established. I may regard with admiration an earlier period, but I acquiesce in the present, and while I pray for good emperors, I can endure whomsoever we may have. It was not through my speech any more than it was through the judgment of the Senate that Thrasea fell. The savage temper of Nero amused itself under these forms, and I found the friendship of such a prince as harassing as others found their exile. Finally, Helvidius may rival the Catos and the Bruti of old in constancy and courage. I am but one of the Senate which bows to the same yoke. Besides, I would advise Priscus not to climb higher than the throne, or to impose his counsels on Vespasian, an old man, who has won the honors of a triumph, and has two sons grown to manhood. For as the worst emperors love an unlimited despotism, so the noblest like some check on liberty." These speeches, which were delivered with much vehemence on both sides, were heard with much diversity of feeling. That party prevailed, which preferred that the envoys should be taken by lot, as even the neutral selection of the Senate exerted itself to retain the old practice, while the more conspicuous members inclined to the same view, dreading jealousy should the choice fall on themselves. Another struggle ensued. The praetors of the treasury, the treasury was at this time managed by praetors, complained of the poverty of the state and demanded a retrenchment of expenditure. The consul-elect, considering how great was the evil and how difficult the remedy, was for reserving the matter for the emperor. Helvidius gave it as his opinion that measures should be taken at the discretion of the Senate. When the consuls came to take the votes, Vocatius Tertullianus, praetor of the people, put his veto on any resolution being adopted in so important a manner in the absence of the emperor. Helvidius had moved that the capital should be restored at the public expense, and that Vespasian should give his aid. All the more moderate of the senators let his opinion pass in silence, and in time forgot it, but there were some who remembered it. Musonius Rufus then made a violent attack on Publius Celer, accusing him of having brought about the destruction of Barius Serranus by perjury. By this impeachment, all the hatreds of the days of the informers seemed to be revived. But the accused person was so worthless and so guilty that he could not be protected. For indeed the memory of Serranus was held in reverence. Celer had been a professor of philosophy, and had then given evidence against Barea, thus betraying and profaning the friendship of which he claimed to be a teacher. The next day was fixed for the trial, but it was not of Musonius or Publius, it was of Priscus, of Marcellus, and his brother informers that men were thinking, now that their hearts were once roused to vengeance. While things were in this state, while there was division in the Senate, resentment among the conquered, no real authority in the conquerors, and in the country at large no laws and no emperor, Mucanius entered the capital, and at once drew all power into his own hands. The influence of Primus Antonius and Varus Arius was destroyed, for the irritation of Mucanius against them, though not revealed in his looks, was but ill-concealed, and the country, keen to discover such dislikes, had changed its tone and transferred its homage. He alone was canvassed and courted, and he, surrounding himself with armed men, and bargaining for palaces and gardens, ceased not, what with his magnificence, his proud bearing, and his guards, to grasp at the power, while he waved the titles of empire. The murder of Calpurnius Galerianus caused the utmost consternation. He was a son of Gaius Piso, and had done nothing, but a noble name and his own youthful beauty made him the theme of common talk, and while the country was still unquiet and delighted in novel topics, there were persons who associated him with idle rumors of imperial honors. By order of Mucianus, he was surrounded with a guard of soldiers. Lest his execution in the capital should excite too much notice, they conducted him to the 40th milestone from Rome on the Appian Road, and there put him to death by opening his veins. Julius Priscus, who had been prefect of the Praetorian Guard under Vitellius, killed himself rather out of shame than by compulsion. Alfenius Varus survived the disgrace of his cowardice. Asiaticus, who was only a freedman, expiated by the death of a slave his evil exercise of power. At this time the country was hearing, with anything but sorrow, rumors that daily gained strength of disasters in Germany. Men began to speak of slaughtered armies, of captured encampments, of Gaul in revolt, as if such things were not calamities. Beginning at an earlier period, I will discuss the causes in which this war had its origin, and the extent of the movements which it kindled among independent and allied nations. The Batavians, while they dwelt on the other side of the Rhine, formed a part of the tribe of the Chatti. Driven out by a domestic revolution, they took possession of an uninhabited country on the extremity of the coast of Gaul, and also of a neighboring island, surrounded by the ocean in front and by the river Rhine in the rear and on either side. Not weakened by the power of Rome, or by alliance with a people stronger than themselves, they furnished to the empire nothing but men and arms. They had had a long training in the German wars, and they had gained further renown in Britain, to which country their cohorts had been transferred, commanded, according to ancient custom, by the noblest men in the nation. They had also at home a select body of cavalry, who practiced with special devotion the art of swimming, so that they could stem the stream of the Rhine with their arms and horses, without breaking the order of their squadrons. Julius Paulus and Claudius Civilis, scions of the royal family, ranked very high above the rest of their nation. Paulus was executed by Fontius Capito on a false charge of rebellion. Civilis was put in chains and sent to Nero, and though acquitted by Galba, stood again in peril of his life in the time of Vitellius, when the army clamored for his execution. Here were the causes of deep offense. Hence arose hopes built on our disasters. Civilis, however, was naturally politic to a degree rarely found among barbarians. He was wont to represent himself as Sertorius or Hannibal, on the strength of a similar disfigurement of his countenance. to avoid the opposition which he would encounter as a public enemy, were he openly to revolt from Rome, he affected a friendship for Vespasian, and a zealous attachment to his party, and indeed a letter had been dispatched to him by Primus Antonius, in which he was directed to divert the reinforcements which Vitellius had called up, and to keep the legions where they were by the feint of an outbreak in Germany. The same policy was suggested by Hordeanus in person. He had a bias towards Vespasian, and feared for the empire, the utter ruin of which would be very near, were a fresh war with so many thousands of armed men to burst upon Italy. Civilis, who was resolved on rebellion, and intended, while concealing his ulterior designs, to reveal his other plans as occasion presented itself, set about the work of revolution in this way. By command of Vitellius, all the Batavian youth were then being summoned to the conscription, a thing naturally vexatious, and which the officials made yet more burdensome by their rapacity and profligacy, while they selected aged and infirmed persons, whom they might discharge for consideration, and mere striplings, but of distinguished beauty, and many obtained even in boyhood to a noble stature, whom they dragged off for infamous purposes. This caused indignation, and the ringleaders of the concerted rebellion prevailed upon the people to refuse the conscription. Civilis collected at one of the sacred groves, ostensibly for a banquet, the chiefs of the nation and the boldest spirits of the lower classes. When he saw them warmed with the festivities of the night, he began by speaking of the renown and glory of their race, and then counted the wrongs and the oppressions which they endured, and all the other evils of slavery. "There is," he said, "no alliance, as once there was. We are treated as slaves. When does even a legate come among us, though he come only with a burdensome retinue, and in all the haughtiness of power? We are handed over to the prefects and centurions, and when they are glutted with our spoils and our blood, then they are changed, and new receptacles for plunder, new terms for spoliation are discovered. Now the conscription is at hand, tearing, we may say, forever children from parents, and brothers from brothers. Never has the power of Rome been more depressed. In the winter quarters of the legions there is nothing but property to plunder and a few old men. Only dare to look up and cease to tremble at the empty names of legions, for we have a vast force of horse and foot. We have the Germans, our kinsmen. We have Gaul bent on the same objects. Even to the Roman people this war will not be displeasing. If defeated, we shall still reckon it a service to Vespasian, and for success no account need be rendered." Having been listened to with great approval, he bound the whole assembly with barbarous rites and the national form of oath. Envoys were sent to the Canephates to urge a common policy. This is a tribe which inhabits part of the island, and closely resembles the Batavians in their origin, their language, and their courageous character, but is inferior in numbers. After this he sent messengers to tamper with the British auxiliaries and with the Batavian cohorts, who, as I have before related, had been sent into Germany, and were then stationed at Mogotiacum. Among the Canephates there was a certain Brino, a man of a certain stolid bravery, and of distinguished birth. His father, after venturing on many acts of hostility, had scorned with impunity the ridiculous expedition of Caligula. His very name, the name of a family of rebels, made him popular. Raised aloft on a shield after the national fashion, and balanced on the shoulders of the bearers, he was chosen general. Immediately summoning to the arms the Frisii, a tribe of the farther bank of the Rhine, he assailed by sea the winter quarters of two cohorts, which was the nearest point to attack. The soldiers had not anticipated the assault of the enemy. Even had they done so, they had not the strength to repulse it. Thus the camp was taken and plundered. Then the enemy fell upon the settlers and Roman traders, who were wandering about in every direction, as they would in a time of peace. At the same time they were on the point of destroying the forts, but the prefects of the cohorts, seeing that they could not hold them, set them on fire. The standards, the colors, and what soldiers there were, concentrated themselves in the upper part of the island, under the command of Aquilius, a centurion of the first rank, an army in name rather than in strength. Vitellius, in fact, after withdrawing the effective troops from the cohorts, had loaded with arms a crowd of idlers from the neighboring villages of the Nervii and the Germans. Civilis, thinking that he must proceed by craft, actually blamed the prefects for having deserted the forts, saying that he would himself, with the cohort under his command, quell the disturbance among the Canafates, and that they had better return to their respective winter quarters. It was evident, however, that there was some treacherous design beneath this advice, that the cohorts would be dispersed only to be more easily crushed, and that the guiding hand in the war was not Brino, but Civilis, for indications of the truth, with the Germans, a people who delight in war, could not long conceal, were gradually coming to light. When stratagem proved ineffectual, he resorted to force, arranging in distinct columns the Canafates, the Batavians, and the Frisii. The Roman army was drawn up to meet them not far from the river Rhine, and the ships, which, after burning the forts, they had stranded at that point, were arranged so as to front the enemy. Before the struggle had lasted long, a cohort of Tungrians carried over their standards to Civilis. The other troops, paralyzed by the unexpected desertion, were cut down alike by friends and foes. In the fleet there was the same treachery. Some of the rowers were Batavians, and they hindered the operations of the sailors and combatants by an apparent want of skill. Then they began to back water, and to run the sterns on the hostile shore. At last they killed the pilots and centurions, unless these were willing to join them. The end was that the whole fleet of 24 vessels was deserted or was taken. For the moment this was a brilliant success, and had its use for the future. They possessed themselves of some arms and some vessels, both of which they wanted, while they became very famous throughout Germany as the champions of liberty. The tribes of Germany immediately sent envoys with offers of troops. The cooperation of Gaul, Civilis endeavored to secure by politic liberality, sending back to their respective states the captured prefects of cohorts, and giving permission to their men to go or to stay as they preferred. He offered to those who stayed service on honorable terms, to those who departed the spoils of the Roman army. At the same time he reminded them in confidential conversations of the wrongs which they had endured for so many years, while they falsely gave to a wretched slavery the name of peace. "The Batavians," he said, "though free of tribute, have yet taken up arms against our common masters. In the first conflict the soldiers of Rome have been routed and vanquished. What will be the result if Gaul throws off the yoke? What strength is there yet left in Italy? It is by the blood of the provinces that the provinces are conquered. Think not of how it fared with the armies of Vindex. It was by Batavian cavalry that the Aedui and the Averni were trampled down, and among the auxiliaries of Varangius they were found Belgian troops. To those who will estimate the matter aright, it is evident that Gaul fell by her own strength. But now all are on the same side, and we have whatever remnant of military vigor still flourished in the camps of Rome. With us too are the veteran cohorts to which the legions of Otho lately succumbed. Let Syria, Asia Minor, and the East, habituated as it is to despotism, submit to slavery. There are many yet alive in Gaul who were born before the days of tribute. It was only lately indeed that Quintilius Varus was slain, and slavery driven out of Germany. And the emperor who was challenged by that war was not a Vitellius, but a Caesar Augustus. Freedom is a gift bestowed by nature on even the dumb animals. Courage is the peculiar excellence of man, and the gods help the braver side. Let us then, who are free to act and vigorous, fall on a distracted and exhausted enemy. While some are supporting Vespasian and others Vitellius, opportunities are opening up for acting against both." Civilis, bent on winning Gaul and Germany if his purposes should prosper, was on the point of securing supremacy over the most powerful and most wealthy of the states. His first attempts Hordeonius Flaccus had encouraged by affecting ignorance, But when messengers came, hurrying in with intelligence that a camp had been stormed, that cohorts had been cut to pieces, and that the Roman power had been expelled from the island of the Batavians, the general ordered the legate, Munius Lupercus, who was in command of the winter quarters of the two legions, to advance against the enemy. Lupercus, in great haste, threw across the Rhine such legionaries as were on the spot, some Ubian troops who were close at hand, and some cavalry of the Treveri, who were stationed at no great distance. These were accomplished by some Batavian horse, who, though they had been long disaffected, yet still simulated loyalty, in order that by betraying the Romans in the moment of actual conflict, they might receive a higher price for their desertion. Civilis, surrounding himself with the standards of the captured cohorts, to keep their recent honors before the eyes of his own men, and to terrify the enemy by the remembrance of defeat, now directed his own mother and sisters and the wives and children of all his men to stand in the rear, where they might encourage to victory or shame defeat. The war song of the men and the shrill cries of the women rose from the whole line, and an answering but far less vigorous cheer came from the legions and auxiliaries. The Batavians had exposed the left wing by their desertion, and they immediately turned against our men. Still the legionaries, though their position was alarming, kept their arms and their ranks. The auxiliaries of Ubii and Treveri broke at once in shameful flight and dispersed over the whole country. On that side the Germans threw the weight of their attack. Meanwhile the legions had an opportunity of retreating into what was called the old camp. Claudius Labio, prefect of the Batavian horse, who had been the rival of Civilis in some local contest, was sent away into the country of the Frisii. To kill him might be to give offense to his countrymen, while to keep him with the army might be to sow the seeds of discord. End of Book 4, Part 1. Book 4, Part 2 of the Histories by Publius Cornelius Tacitus. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Histories by Publius Cornelius Tacitus, translated by Alfred John Church and William Jackson Brodribb. Book 4, January to November, A.D. 70. Part 2. About the same time the messenger dispatched by Civilis came up with the cohorts of the Batavians and the Canephates, while by the orders of Vitellius they were advancing towards Rome. At once, inflated with pride and haughtiness, they demanded, by way of remuneration for their march, a donative, double pay, and an increase in the number of cavalry, things indeed which Vitellius had promised, but which they now asked, not with the thought of obtaining them, but as a pretext for mutiny. Flaccus, by his many concessions, had produced no other effect but to make them insist with more energy on what they knew he must refuse. Treating him with contempt, they made their way towards Lower Germany, to join Civilis. Hordeonius assembled the tribunes and centurions, asked their opinions as to whether he should use coercion with those who refused obedience. Soon, yielding to his natural timidity and to the alarm of his officers, who were troubled by the suspicious temper of the auxiliaries, and by the fact that the ranks of the legions had been recruited by a hurried conscription, he resolved to confine his troops to the camp. Then, repenting of his resolve, and finding that the very men who had advised it now disapproved it, he seemed bent on pursuing the enemy, and wrote to Herennius Gallus, legate of the first legion, who was then holding Bona, that he was to prevent the Batavians from crossing the Rhine, and that he would himself hang on their rear with his army. They might have been crushed if Hordeonius, moving from one side, and Gallus from the other, had enclosed them between their armies. But Flaccus abandoned his purpose, and in other dispatches to Gallus, recommended him not to threaten the departing foe. Thence arose the suspicion that the war was being kindled by the consent of the legates, and that everything which had happened, or was apprehended, was due, not to the cowardice of the troops, or to the strength of the enemy, but to the treachery of the generals. When the Batavians were near the camp at Bona, they sent on before them delegates, commissioned to deliver to Herennius Gallus a message from the cohorts. It was to this effect: "We have no quarrel with the Romans, for whom we have so often fought. Wearied with a protracted and fruitless service, we long for our native land and for rest. If no one oppose us, our march will be harmless, but if an armed force encounter us, we will make away with a sword." The soldiers prevailed upon the hesitating legate to risk the chances of a battle. 3,000 legionaries, some raw Belgian cohorts, and with them a mob of rustics and camp followers, cowardly but bold of speech before the moment of danger, rushed out of all the gates, thinking to surround the Batavians, who were inferior in number. But the enemy, being veteran troops, formed in columns, presenting on every side a dense array, with front, flanks, and rear secure. Thus they were able to break the thin line of our soldiers. The Belgians giving way, the legion was driven back, retreating in confusion on the entrenchments and the gates. It was there that the greatest slaughter took place. The trenches were heaped with corpses. Nor was it only from the deadly blows of the enemy that they suffered. Many perished in the crush and by their own weapons. The victorious army, who avoided the Colonia Agrippinensis, did not venture on any other hostile act during the remainder of their march, and excused the conflict at Bona, alleging that they had asked for peace, and that when it was refused they had but looked to their own safety. Givilus, who now on the arrival of these veteran cohorts was at the head of a complete army, but who was undecided in his plans and still reflected on the power of Rome, made all who were with him swear allegiance to Vespasian, and sent envoys to the two legions, which after their defeat in the previous engagement had retreated into the old camp, advising them to accept the same allegiance. Their reply was, "We do not follow the advice of traitors or enemies. Vitellius is our emperor. To him we will retain our fealty and devote our swords to our last breath. Then let not a Batavian refugee affect to decide the destinies of Rome. Let him rather await the merited penalty of his guilt." When this reply was delivered to Civilis, he was furious with anger, and hurried the whole Batavian nation into open war. The Bructeri and Tancteri joined him, and messengers summoned all Germany to share in his plunder and his glory. To meet the threatened dangers of the gathering war, the legates of the legions, Minurius Lupercus and Numicius Rufus, strengthened their entrenchments and walls. The buildings, which during a long period of peace had grown up like a town near the camp, were destroyed, lest they might be useful to the enemy. Little care, however, was taken about the conveyance of supplies into the camp. These the generals allowed to be plundered, and so what might have long have sufficed for their necessities was wantonly wasted in a few days. Civilis, who occupied the center of the army with the elite of the Batavian troops, wishing to add a new terror to his demonstration, covered both banks of the Rhine with columns of his German allies, while his cavalry galloped about the plains. At the same time the fleet was moved up the stream. Here were the standards of the veteran cohorts. There the images of wild beasts, brought out of the woods and sacred groves, under the various forms which each tribe is used to follow into battle, and these mingled emblems of civil and of foreign warfare utterly confounded the besieged. The extent of the entrenchment raised the hopes of the besiegers. Constructed for two legions, it was now held by not more than 5,000 Roman soldiers. But there was with them a great number of camp followers, who had assembled there on the disturbance of peace, and who could be employed in the contest. Part of the camp occupied the gentle slope of a hill. To part was a level approach. But by this encampment, Augustus had thought the German tribes might be watched and checked. Never had he contemplated such a pitch of disaster as that these tribes should themselves advance to attack our legions. Hence no labor was bestowed on the ground or on the defenses. Our valor and our arms seemed defense enough. The Batavians and the Transharene tribes took up their position, each tribe by itself, to distinguish and so the better to display the valor of each, first annoying us by a distant volley. Then, as they found that very many of their missiles fixed themselves harmlessly in the turrets and battlements of the walls, and that they themselves suffered from the stones showered down upon them, they fell on the entrenchments with a stout and furious rush, many placing their scaling ladders against the ramparts, and others mounting on a testudo formed by their comrades. Some were in the act of climbing over when they were thrust down by the swords of the enemy, and fell overwhelmed by a storm of javelins and stakes. Always very daring at first, and excessively elated by success, they now, in their eagerness for plunder, bore up against every reverse. They also ventured to use what to them was a novelty, engines of war. They had themselves no skill in handling them, but the prisoners and deserters taught them to pile up timber in the shape of a bridge, under which they put wheels, and so propelled, some standing on the top and fighting as they would upon an earthwork, others concealing themselves within and undermining the walls. But the stones thrown by the catapults prostrated the ill-constructed fabric, and when they set themselves to prepare hurdles and mantlets, burning spears were thrown on them by the engines, fire being thus actually used against the assailants. At last, despairing of success by force, they changed their plans and resolved to wait, for they were well aware that only a few days' provisions were in the camp, and that there were a great crowd of non-combatants, and they counted at the same time on the treachery which might follow on scarcity, on the wavering fidelity of the slaves, and on the chances of war. Meanwhile, Flaccus, who had heard this of the siege of the camp and had sent into all parts of Gaul to collect auxiliaries, put under command of Dilius Vocula, legate of the 18th legion, some troops picked from the legions with orders to hasten by forced marches upon the banks of the Rhine. Flaccus himself, who was weak in health and disliked by his troops, traveled with the fleet. The troops indeed complained in unmistakable language that their general had dispatched the Batavian cohorts from Mangantiantum, had feigned ignorance of the plans of Civilis, and was inviting the German tribes to join the league. This, they said, had strengthened Vespasian no less than the exertions of Primus Antonius and Mucianus. Declared enmity and hostility may be openly repulsed, but treachery and fraud work in darkness, and so cannot be avoided. Civilis stands in arms against us, and arranges the order of his battle. Hordionius from his chamber or his litter gives such orders as may best serve the enemy. The swords of thousands of brave men are directed by one old man's sick caprice. How much better by slaying the traitor, and to set free our valor and our fortune from these evil auspices. The passions, already kindled by the language which they thus held among themselves, were yet more inflamed by a dispatch from Vespasian, which Flaccus, finding that it could no longer be concealed, read before an assembly of the troops, sending the persons which had brought it in chains to Vitellius. With feelings somewhat appeased, they arrived at Bona, the winter camp of the first legion. The troops were there even more enraged against Hordionius, and laid on him the blame of the late disaster. They said that it was by his orders that they had offered battle to the Batavians, supposing that the legions from Monacetiacum were following them, that it was through his treachery that they had been slaughtered, no reinforcements coming up, that all these events were unknown to the other legions, and were not told to the emperor, though the sudden outburst of treason might have been crushed by the prompt action of so many provinces. Hordionius read to the army copies of all the letters which he had sent about Gaul, begging for reinforcements, and established as a precedent a most disgraceful practice, namely, the handing over the dispatches to the standard-bearers of the legions, through whose means they were read to the soldiers sooner than by the generals. He then ordered one of the mutineers to be put in irons, more for the sake of asserting his authority than because any one man was in fault. The army was then moved from Bona to the Colonia Agrippinensis, where auxiliaries from Gaul continued to flow in, for at first that nation zealously supported the cause of Rome. Soon indeed, as the Germans increased in power, many of the states took up arms against us, moved by the hopes of freedom, and, could they once shake off the yoke, even by the lust of empire. The irritation of the legions still increased, nor had the imprisonment of a single soldier struck them with terror. This fellow, indeed, actually charged the general with complicity. He had, he said, acted as a messenger between Civilis and Flaccus, and because he might tell the truth he was now being crushed under a false charge. With wonderful firmness, Vocula ascended the tribunal, and ordered the man who had been seized by the lictors and was loudly remonstrating, to be led off to execution. All the best men acquiesced in the order, while the ill-affected were struck with terror. Then, as all with common consent demanded that Vocula should be their general, Hordeonius handed over to him the supreme command. But there were many things to exasperate the already divided feelings of the soldiery. Pay and provisions were scanty. Gaul was rebelling against conscription and taxes, while the Rhine, owing to a drought unexampled in that climate, would hardly admit of navigation. And thus supplies were straitened, at the same time that outposts had to be established along the entire bank to keep the Germans from fording the stream. The selfsame cause thus bringing about a smaller supply of grain and a greater number of consumers. Among ignorant persons, the very failure of the stream was regarded as a prodigy, as if the very rivers, the old defenses of the empire, were deserting us. What in peace would have seemed chance or nature was now spoken of as destiny and the anger of heaven. As the army entered Novaesium, the 16th legion joined it. Herennius Gallus, its legate, was associated with Vocula in the responsibilities of command. As they did not venture to advance upon the enemy, they constructed a camp at a place called Galduba. Here the general sought to give steadiness to the troops by such exercises as forming in the order of battle, constructing fortifications, making entrenchments, and whatever else might train them for war. In the hope that they might be fired to courage by the delights of plunder, Vocula led the army against the nearest villages of the Gugerni, who had accepted the alliance of Civilis. Some of the troops remained permanently with Herennius Gallus. One day it happened that at no great distance from the camp the Germans were endeavoring to drag off to their own bank a vessel laden with corn, which had run aground in the shallows. Gallus could not endure this and sent a cohort to help. The number of the Germans also increased, as fresh troops continued to join both sides. A regular battle ensued. The Germans, besides inflicting great loss on our men, carried off the vessel. The vanquished troops, following what had become a regular practice, laid the blame not on their own cowardice, but on supposed treachery in the legate. Dragged out of his tent, his garments torn, and his person severely beaten, he was commanded to declare for what bribe and with what accomplices he had betrayed the army. Their old hatred of Hordeonius reappeared. He, they declared, was the instigator of the crime, Gallus his tool. At last, utterly terrified by their threats of instant death, the legate himself charged Hordeonius with treachery. He was then put in irons, and only released on the arrival of Vocula, who, the next day, inflicted capital punishment on the ringleaders of the mutiny. Such wide extremities of license and of subordination were to be found in that army. The common soldiers were undoubtedly loyal to Vitellius, but all the most distinguished men were in favor of Vespasian. The result was an alternation of outbreaks and executions, and a strange mixture of obedience and frenzy, which made it impossible to restrain the men whom it was yet possible to punish. Meanwhile, all Germany was raising the power of Civilis by vast additions of strength, and the alliance was secured by hostages of the noblest rank. He directed that the territories of the Ubii and the Treveri should be ravaged by several tribes on which they bordered, and that another detachment should cross the river Mosa to threaten the Menapii and the Morini and the frontiers of Gaul. In both quarters, plunder was collected, with peculiar hostility in the case of the Ubii, because this nation, being of German origin, had forsworn its native country and assumed the Roman name of the Agrippinenses. Their cohorts were cut up at the village of Marcodorum, where they lay with careless security, presuming on their distance from the river bank. The Ubii did not remain quiet, but made predatory excursions into Germany, escaping at first with impunity, though they were afterwards cut off. Throughout the whole of this war, they were more loyal than fortunate. Civilis, grown more formidable now that the Ubii had been crushed, and elated by the successes of his operations, pressed on the siege of the legions, keeping a strict watch to prevent any secret intelligence of advancing succors from reaching them. He entrusted to the Batavians the care of the machines and the vast siege works, and when the Transhennine tribes clamored for battle, he bade them go and cut through the ramparts, and, if repulsed, renew the struggle. Their numbers were superfluously large, and their loss was not felt. Even darkness did not terminate the struggle. Piling up logs of wood round the walls and lighting them, they sat feasting and rushed to the conflict, as each grew heated with wine, with a useless daring. Their missiles were discharged without effect in the darkness, but to the Romans the ranks of the barbarians were plainly discernible, and they singled out with deliberate aim anyone whose boldness or whose decorations made him conspicuous. Civilis saw this, and, extinguishing the fires, threw the confusion of darkness over the attack. Then ensued a scene of discordant clamor, of accident and uncertainty, where no one could see how to aim or to avoid a blow. Wherever a shout was heard, they could see how to aim. They wheeled round and strained hand and foot. Valor was of no avail. Accident disturbed every plan, and the bravest frequently were struck down by the missiles of the coward. The Germans fought with inconsiderate fury. Our men, more alive to the danger, threw, but not at random, stakes shod with iron and heavy stones. Where the noises of the assailants were heard, or where the ladders placed against the walls brought the enemy within reach of their hands, they pushed them back with their shields, and followed them with their javelins. Many who had struggled on to the walls they stabbed with their short swords. After a night thus spent, day revealed a new method of attack. The Batavians had raised a tower 2 stories high, which they had brought up the Praetorian gate of the camp, where the ground was the most level. But our men pushed forward strong poles, battering it with beams, broke it down, causing great destruction among the combatants on the top. The enemy were attacked in their confusion by a sudden and successful sally. All this time many engines were constructed by the legionaries, who were superior to the enemy in experience and skill. Peculiar consternation was caused by a machine which, being poised in the air over the heads of the enemy, suddenly descended, and carried up one or more of them past the faces of their friends, and then, by a shifting of the weight, projected them within the limits of the camp. Civilis, giving up all hope of a successful assault, again sat down to blockade the camp at his leisure, and undermine the fidelity of the legions by the promises of his emissaries. All these events in Germany took place before the battle of Cremona, the result of which was announced in a dispatch from Antonius, accompanied by Caecina's proclamation. Alpinius Montanus, prefect of a cohort in the vanquished army, was on the spot, and acknowledged the fate of his party. Various were the emotions thus excited. The Gallic auxiliaries, who felt neither affection nor hatred towards either party, and who served without attachment, at once, at the insistence of their prefects, deserted Vitellius. The veteran soldiers hesitated. Nevertheless, when Hordionius administered the oath, under a strong pressure from their tribunes, they pronounced the words, which their looks and their temper belied, and while they adopted every other expression, they hesitated at the name of Vespasian, passing it over with a slight murmur, and not unfrequently in absolute silence. After this, certain letters from Antonius to Civilis were read in full assembly, and provoked the suspicions of the soldiery, as they seemed to be addressed to a partisan of the cause, and to be unfriendly to the army of Germany. Soon the news reached the camp of Galduba, and the same language and the same acts were repeated. Montanus was sent with a message to Civilis, bidding him to desist from hostilities, and not to seek to conceal the designs of an enemy by fighting under false colors, and telling him that, if he had been attempting to assist Vespasian, his purpose had been fully accomplished. Civilis at first replied in artful language, but soon perceiving that Montanus was a man of singularly high spirit, and was himself disposed for change, he began with lamenting the perils through which he had struggled for 25 years in the camps of Rome. "It is," he said, "a noble and savage clamor of this army, a clamor which demanded my execution, and for which by the law of nations I demand vengeance. You, Trivari, and other enslaved creatures, what reward do you expect for the blood which you have shed so often? What but a hateful service, perpetual tribute, the rod, the axe, and the passions of a ruling race? See how I, the prefect of a single cohort, with the Batavians and the Canaphates, a mere fraction of Gaul have destroyed their vast but useless camps, or are pressing them with the closed blockade of famine and the sword. In a word, either freedom will follow on our efforts, or, if we are vanquished, we shall but be what we were before." Having thus fired the man's ambition, Civilis dismissed him, but bade him carry back a milder answer. He returned, pretending to have failed in his mission, but not revealing the other facts. These, indeed, soon came to light. Civilis, retaining a part of his forces, sent the veteran cohorts and the bravest of his German troops against Vocula and his army, under the command of Julius Maximus and Claudius Victor, his sister's son. On their march they plundered the winter camp of a body of horse stationed at Ascibergium, and they fell on Vocula's camp so unexpectedly that he could neither harangue his army nor even get it into line. All that he could do in the confusion was to order the veteran troops to strengthen the center. The auxiliaries were dispersed in every part of the field. The cavalry charged, but, received by the orderly array of the enemy, fled to their own lines. What ensued was a massacre rather than a battle. The Nervian infantry, from panic or from treachery, exposed the flank of our army. Thus the attack fell upon the legions, who had lost their standards and were being cut down within the entrenchments, when the fortune of the day was suddenly changed by a reinforcement of fresh troops. Some Vascon infantry, levied by Galba, which had by this time been sent for, heard the noise of the combatants as they approached the camp, attacked the rear of the preoccupied enemy, and spread a panic more than proportionate to their numbers, some believing that all the troops from Novesium, others that all from Mogontiacum had come up. This delusion restored the courage of the Romans, and in relying on the strength of others they recovered their own. All the bravest of the Batavians, of the infantry at least, fell, but the cavalry escaped with the standards and with the prisoners whom they had secured in the early part of the engagement. Of the slain on that day the greater number belonged to our army, but to its less effective part. The Germans lost the flower of their force. The two generals were equally blameworthy. They deserved defeat. They did not make the most of success. Had Civilis given battle in greater force, he could not have been outflanked by so small a number of cohorts, and he might have destroyed the camp after once forcing an entrance. As for Vocula, he did not reconnoitre the advancing enemy, and consequently he was vanquished as soon as he left the camp, and then, mistrusting his victory, he fruitlessly wasted several days before marching against the enemy, though, had he at once resolved to drive them back, and to follow up his success, he might, by one and the same movement, have raised the siege of the legions. Meanwhile, Civilis had tried to work on the feelings of the besieged, by representing that, with the Romans, all was lost, and that victory had been declared for his own troops. The standards and colors were carried around the ramparts, and the prisoners also were displayed. One of them, with noble daring, declared the real truth in a loud voice, and, as he was cut down on the spot by the Germans, all the more confidence was felt in his information. At the same time, it was becoming evident, from the devastation of the country and from the flames of burning houses, that the victorious army was approaching. Vocula issued orders that the standard should be planted within sight of the camp, and should be surrounded with a ditch and a rampart, where his men might deposit their knapsacks, and so fight without encumbrance. On this the general was assailed by a clamorous demand for instant battle. They had now grown used to threaten. Without even taking time to form into line, disordered and weary as they were, they commenced the action. Civilis was on the field, trusting quite as much to the faults of his adversaries as to the valor of his own troops. With the Romans the fortune of the day varied, and the most violently mutinous showed themselves cowards. But some, remembering their recent victory, stood their ground, and struck fiercely at the foe, now encouraging each other and their neighbors, and now, while they reformed their lines, imploring the besieged not to lose the opportunity. These latter, who saw everything from the walls, sallied out from the gate. It so happened that Civilis was thrown to the ground by the fall of his horse. A report that he had been either wounded or slain gained belief throughout both armies, and spread incredible panic among his own troops, and gave as great encouragement to their opponents. But Vocula, leaving the flying foe, began to strengthen the rampart and the towers of the camp, as if another siege was imminent. He had misused success so often that he was rightly suspected of a preference for war. Nothing distressed our troops so much as the scarcity of supplies. The baggage of the legions was therefore sent to Novaesium, with a crowd of non-combatants to fetch corn from that place overland, for the enemy commanded the river. The march of the first body was accomplished in security, as Civilis had not yet recovered, but when he heard that officers of the commissariat had been again sent to Novaesium, and that the infantry detached as an escort were advancing just as it were in a time of profound peace, with but few soldiers round the standards, the arms stowed away in the wagons, and all wandering about at their pleasure, he attacked them in regular form, having first sent on troops to occupy the bridges and defiles in the road. The battle extended over a long line of march, lasting with varying success till night parted the combatants. The infantry pushed on to Gelduba, while the camp remained in the same state as before, garrisoned by such troops as had been left in it. There could be no doubt what peril a convoy, heavily laden and panic-stricken, would have to encounter in attempting to return. Vocula added to his own force 1,000 picked men from the 5th and 15th Legion, besieged in the old camp, a body of troops undisciplined and ill-affected to their officers. But more than that number specified came forward, and openly protested, as they marched, that they would not endure any longer the hardships of famine and the treachery of the legates. On the other hand, those who had stayed behind complained that they were being left to their fate by this withdrawal of a part of the legions. A twofold mutiny was the result, some calling on Vocula to come back, while the others refused to return to the camp. Meanwhile, Civilis blockaded the old camp. Vocula retired first to Gelduba, afterwards to Novaesium. Civilis took possession of Gelduba, and not long after was victorious in a cavalry engagement near Novaesium. But reverses and successes seemed equally to kindle in the troops the one desire of murdering their officers. The legions, increased in number by the arrival of the men of the 5th and 15th, demanded a donative, for they had discovered that some money had been spent by Vitellius. After a short delay, Hordionius gave the donative in the name of Vespasian. This, more than anything else, fostered the mutinous spirit. The men, abandoning themselves to debauchery and revelry and all the license of nightly gatherings, reviled their old grudge against Hordionius. Without a single legate or tribune venturing to check them, for the darkness seems to have taken from them all sense of shame, they dragged him out of his bed and killed him. The same fate was intended for Vocula, but he assumed the dress of a slave and escaped unrecognized in the darkness. When their fury had subsided, and their alarm returned, they sent centurions with dispatches to the various states of Gaul, imploring help in money and troops. End of Book 4, Part 2. Book 4, Part 3. Of the Histories by Publius Cornelius Tacitus. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Histories by Publius Cornelius Tacitus, translated by Alfred John Church and William Jackson Brodribb. Book 4, January to November, A.D. 70. Part 3. These men, headstrong, cowardly, and spiritless, as a mob without a leader always is, on the approach of Civilis, hastily took up arms, and, as hastily abandoning them, betook themselves to flight. Disaster produced disunion. The troops from the upper army, disassociating their cause from that of their comrades. Nevertheless, the statues of Vitellius were again set up in the camp, and in the neighboring Belgian towns, and this at a time when Vitellius himself had fallen. Then the men of the 1st, the 4th, and the 18th legions, repenting of their conduct, followed Vocula, and again, taking in his presence the oath of allegiance to Vespasian, were marched by him to the relief of Mogontiacum. The besieging army, an heterogeneous mass of Chatti, Usipii, and Matiaci, had raised the siege, glutted with spoils, but not without suffering loss. Our troops attacked them on the way, dispersed and unprepared. Moreover, the Treveri had constructed a breastwork and rampart across their territory, and they and the Germans continued to contend with great losses on both sides up to the time when they tarnished by rebellion their distinguished services to the Roman people. Meanwhile, Vespasian, now consul for the second time, and Titus entered upon their office, both being absent from Rome. People were gloomy and anxious under the pressure of manifold fears, for, over and above immediate perils, they had taken groundless alarm under the impression that Africa was in rebellion through the revolutionary movements of Lucius Piso. He was the governor of that province, and was far from being a man of turbulent disposition. The fact was that the wheat ships were detained by the severity of the weather, and the lower orders, who were accustomed to buy their provisions from day to day, and to whom cheap corn was the sole subject of public interest, feared and believed that the ports had been closed and the supply stopped. The Vitellianists, who had not given up their party feelings, helping to spread the report, which was not displeasing even to the conquerors. Their ambition, which even foreign campaigns could not fill to the full, was not satisfied by any triumphs that civil war could furnish. On the 1st of January, at a meeting of the Senate, convoked for the purpose by Julius Frontinus, praetor of the city, votes of thanks were passed to the legates, to the armies, and to the allied kings. The office of praetor was taken away from Tetius Julianus, as having deserted his legion when it passed over to the party of Vespasian, with a view to its being transferred to Plotius Griffus. Equestrian rank was conferred on Hormus. Then, on the resignation of Frontinus, Caesar Domitian assumed the office of praetor of the city. His name was put at the head of despatches and edicts, but the real authority was in the hands of Mucianus, with this exception, that Domitian ventured on several acts of power, at the instigation of his friends or at his own caprice. But Mucianus found his principal cause of apprehension in Primus Antonius and Varus Aureus, who, in the freshness of their fame, while distinguished by great achievements and by the attachment of the soldiery, were also supported by the people, who in no case had they extended their severities beyond the battlefield, had urged Scribonianus Crassus, whom an illustrious descent added to the honors of his brother, made a conspicuous person, to assume the supreme power. And it was understood that a number of accomplices would not have failed to support him, had not the proposal been rejected by Scribonianus, who was a man not easily to be tempted even by a certainty, and was proportionately apprehensive of risk. Mucianus, seeing that Antonius could not be openly crushed, heaped many praises upon him in the Senate, and loaded him with promises in secret, holding out as a prize the government of eastern Spain, then vacant in consequence of the departure of Cluvius Rufus. At the same time he lavished on his friends tribuneships and prefectures, and then, when he had filled the vain heart of the man with hope and ambition, he destroyed his power by sending into winter quarters the 7th Legion, whose affection for Antonius was particularly vehement. The 3rd Legion, old troops of Varius Aureus, were sent back to Syria. Part of the army was on its way to Germany. Thus, all elements of disturbance being removed, the usual appearance of the capital, the laws, and the jurisdiction of the magistrates were once more restored. Domitian, on the day of his taking his seat in the Senate, made a brief and measured speech in reference to the absence of his father and brother, and to his own youth. He was graceful in his bearing, and, his real character being yet unknown, the frequent blush of his countenance passed for modesty. On his proposing the restoration of the imperial honors of Galba, Curtius Montanus moved that respect should also be paid to the memory of Piso. The Senate passed both motions, but that which referred to Piso was not carried out. Certain commissioners were then appointed by lot, who were to see to the restitution of property plundered during the war, to examine and restore to their place the brazen tables of the laws, which had fallen down through age, to free the calendar from the additions which the adulatory spirit of the time had disfigured it, and to put a check on the public expenditure. The office of praetor was restored to Tetius Julianus, as soon as it was known that he had fled for refuge to Vespasian. Griffus still retained his rank. It was then determined that the cause of Musonius Rufus against Publius Celer should again be brought on. Publius was condemned, and thus expiation was made to the shade of Soranus. The day thus marked by an example of public justice was not barren of distinction to individuals. Musonius was thought to have fulfilled the righteous duty of an accuser, but men spoke very differently of Demetrius, a disciple of the cynical school of philosophy, who pleaded the cause of a notorious criminal by appeals to corrupt influences rather than by fair argument. Publius himself, in his peril, had neither spirit nor power of speech left. The signal for vengeance on informers having been thus given, Junius Mauricus had asked Caesar to give the Senate access to the imperial registers, from which they might learn what impeachments the several informers had proposed. Caesar answered that in a matter of such importance the emperor must be consulted. The Senate, led by its principal members, then framed a form of oath, which was eagerly taken by all the magistrates and by the other senators in the order in which they voted. They called the gods to witness that nothing had been done by their instrumentality to prejudice the safety of any person, and that they had gained no distinction or advantage by the ruin of Roman citizens. Great was the alarm, and various the devices for altering the words of the oath, among those who felt the consciousness of guilt. The Senate appreciated the scruple, but denounced the perjury. This public censure, as it might be called, fell with especial severity on three men, Sariolonus Vocula, Nonius Atianus, and Cestius Severus, all of them infamous for having practiced the trade of the informer in the days of Nero. Sariolanus, indeed, labored under an imputation of recent date. It was said that he had attempted the same practices during the reign of Vitellius. The senators did not desist from threatening gestures till he quitted the chamber. Then, passing to Paccius Africanus, they assailed him in the same way. It was he, they said, who had singled out as victims for Nero the brothers Scribonius, renowned for their mutual affection and for their wealth. Africanus dared not confess his guilt and could not deny it, but he himself turned to Vibius Crispus, who was pressing him with questions, and, complicating a charge which he could not rebut, shifted the blame from himself by associating another with his guilt. Great was the reputation for brotherly affection, as well as for eloquence, which Vipstanius Messala earned for himself on that day, by venturing, though not yet of senatorial age, to plead for his brother, Aquilius Regulus. The fall of the families of the Crassi and Orfitus had brought Regulus into the utmost odium. Of his own free will, as it seemed, and while still a mere youth, he had undertaken the prosecution, not to ward off any peril from himself, but in the hope of gaining power. The wife of Crassus, Sulpicia Praetextata, and her four children were ready, should the Senate take cognizance of the cause, to demand vengeance. Accordingly, Messala, without attempting to defend the case or the person accused, had simply thrown himself in the way of the perils that threatened his brother, and had thus wrought upon the feelings of several senators. On this, Curtius Montanus met him with a fierce speech, in which he went to the length of asserting that after the death of Galba, money had been given by Regulus to the murderer of Piso, and that he had even fastened his teeth in the murdered man's head. "Certainly," he said, "Nero did not compel this act. You did not secure by this piece of barbarity either your rank or your life. We may bear with the defense put forward by men who thought it better to destroy others than to come into peril themselves. As for you, the exile of your father and the division of his property among his creditors had left you perfectly safe. Besides that your youth incapacitated you for office, there was nothing in you which Nero could either covet or dread. It was from sheer lust of slaughter and greed of gain that you, unknown as you were, you, who had never pleaded in any man's defense, steeped your soul in noble blood, when, though you had snatched from the very grave of your country the spoils of a man of consular rank, had been fed to the full with 7,000,000 sesterces, and shone with all the sacerdotal honors, you yet overwhelmed in one common ruin innocent boys, old men of illustrious name, and noble ladies, when you actually blamed the tardy movements of Nero in wearying himself and his informers with the overthrow of single families, and declared that the whole Senate might be destroyed by one word. Keep, conscript fathers, preserve a man of such ready counsels, that every age may be furnished with his teacher, and that our young men may imitate Regulus, just as our old men imitate Marcellus and Crispus. Even unsuccessful villainy finds some to emulate it. What will happen if it flourish and be strong? And the man, whom we dare not offend when he holds only the quaestor's rank, are we to see him rise to the dignity of praetor and consul? Do you suppose that Nero will be the last of the tyrants? Those who survived Tiberius, those who survived Caligula, thought the same. Yet after each there arose another ruler, yet more detestable and more cruel. We are not afraid of Vespasian. The age and moderation of the new emperor reassure us. But the influence of an example outlives the individual character. We have lost our vigor, conscript fathers. We are no longer the Senate, which, when Nero had fallen, demanded that the informers and ministers of the tyrant should be punished according to ancient custom. The first day after the downfall of a wicked emperor is the best of opportunities. Montanus was heard with such approval on the part of the Senate that Helvidius conceived a hope that Marcellus also might be overthrown. He therefore began with the panegyric on Cluvius Rufus, who, though not less rich nor less renowned for eloquence, had never imperiled a single life in the days of Nero. By this comparison, as well as by direct accusations, he pressed Aprius hard, and stirred the indignation of the senators. When Marcellus perceived this, he made as if he would leave the house, exclaiming, "We go, Priscus, and leave you your senate. Act the king, though Caesar himself be present." Crispus followed. Both were enraged, but their looks were different. Marcellus cast furious glances about him, while Crispus smiled. They were drawn back, however, into the senate by the hasty interference of friends. The contest grew fiercer, while the well-disposed majority on the one hand and the powerful minority on the other fought out their obstinate quarrel, and thus the day was spent in altercation. At the next meeting of the Senate, Caesar began by recommending that the wrongs, the resentments, and the terrible necessities of former times should be forgotten, and Mucianus spoke at great length in favor of the informers. At the same time he admonished in gentle terms and in a tone of entreaty those who were reviving indictments, which they had before commenced and afterwards dropped. The senators, when they found themselves opposed, relinquished the liberty which they had begun to exercise. That it might not be thought that the opinion of the Senate was disregarded, or that the impunity was accorded to all acts done in the days of Nero, Mucianus sent back to their islands two men of senatorial rank, Octavius Sagitta and Antistius Socianus, who had quitted their places of banishment. Octavius had seduced one Pontia Postuma, and on her refusing to marry him, in the frenzy of passion, had murdered her. Socianus, in his depravity, had brought many to ruin. Both had been condemned and banished by a solemn decision of the Senate, and though others were permitted to return, were kept under the same penalty. But this did not mitigate the hatred felt against Mucianus. Socianus and Sagitta were utterly insignificant, even if they did return, but men dreaded the abilities of the informers, their wealth, and the power which they exercised in many sinister ways. A trial, conducted in the Senate, according to ancient precedents, brought into harmony for a time the feelings of its members. Manlius Patruitus, a senator, laid a complaint that he had been beaten by a mob in the colony of Sena, and that by the order of the magistrates, that the wrong had not stopped here, but that lamentations and wailings, in fact, a representation of funeral obsequies, had been enacted in his presence, accompanied with contemptuous and insulting expressions leveled against the whole Senate. The persons accused were summoned to appear, and after the case had been investigated, punishment was inflicted on those who were found guilty. A resolution of the Senate was also passed, recommending more orderly behavior to the people of Sena. About the same time, Antonius Flamma was condemned under the law against extortion at the suit of the people of Cyrene, and was banished for cruel practices. Amidst all this, a mutiny in the army all but broke out. The troops, who, having been disbanded by Vitellius, had flocked to support Vespasian, asked leave to serve again in the Praetorian Guard, and the soldiers who had been selected from the legions with the same prospect now clamored for their promised pay. Even the Vitellianists could not be got rid of without much bloodshed, but the money required for retaining in the service so vast a body of men was immensely large. Mucianus entered the camp to examine more accurately the individual claims. The victorious army, wearing their proper decorations and arms, he drew up with moderate intervals of space between the divisions. Then the Vitellianists, whose capitulation at Bovillae I have already related, and the other troops of the party, who had been collected from the capital and its neighborhood, were brought forth almost naked. Mucianus ordered these men to be drawn up apart, making the British, the German, and any other troops who were belonging to other armies take up separate positions. The very first view of their situation paralyzed them. They saw opposed to them what seemed an hostile array, threatening them with javelin and sword. They saw themselves hemmed in, without arms, filthy and squalid. And when they began to be separated, some to be marched to one spot, and some to another, a thrill of terror ran through them all. Among the troops from Germany, the panic was particularly great, for they believed that this separation marked them out for slaughter. They embraced their fellow soldiers, clung to their necks, begged for parting kisses, and entreated that they might not be deserted or doomed in a common cause to suffer a different lot. They invoked now Mucianus, now the absent emperor, and, as a last resource, heaven and the gods, till Mucianus came forward, and calling them soldiers bound by the same oath and the servants of the same emperor, stopped the groundless panic. And indeed, the victorious army seconded the tears of the vanquished with their approving shouts. This terminated the proceedings for the day. But when Domitian harangued them a few days afterwards, they received him with increased confidence. The land that was offered them they contemptuously rejected, and begged for regular service and pay. Theirs were prayers indeed, but such as it was impossible to reject. They were therefore received into the Praetorian camp. Then such as had reached the prescribed age, or had served the proper number of campaigns, received an honorable discharge. Others were dismissed for misconduct, but this was done by degrees and in detail, always the safest mode of reducing the united strength of a multitude. It is a fact that, whether suggested by real poverty or by a wish to give the appearance of it, a proposition passed the Senate to the effect that a loan of 60 million sesterces from private persons should be accepted. Pompeius Silvanus was appointed to manage the affair. Before long, either the necessity ceased or the pretense was dropped. After this, on the motion of Domitian, the consulships conferred by Vitellius were cancelled, and the honors of a censor's funeral were paid to Sabinus. Great lessons, both of the mutability of fortune, ever bringing together the highest honors and the lowest humiliations. About the same time the proconsul Lucius Piso was murdered. I shall make the account of this murder as exact as possible by first reviewing a few earlier circumstances which have a bearing on the origin and motives of such deeds. The legion and the auxiliaries stationed in Africa to guard the frontiers of the empire were under the proconsul's authority during the reigns of the divine Augustus and Tiberius. But in the course of time, Caligula, prompted by his restless temper and by his fear of Marcus Silanus, who then held Africa, took away the legion from the proconsul and handed it over to a legate whom he had sent for that purpose. The patronage was equally divided between the two officers. A source of disagreement was thus studiously sought in the continual clashing of their authority, and it was further developed by an unprincipled rivalry. The power of the legates grew through their lengthened tenure of office, and perhaps because an inferior feels greater interest in such a competition. All the more distinguished of the proconsuls cared more for security than for power. At this time, the legion in Africa was commanded by Valerius Festus, a young man of extravagant habits and immoderate ambition, who was now made uneasy by his relationship to Vitellius. Whether this man, in their frequent interviews, tempted Piso to revolt, or whether he resisted such overtures is not known for certain, for no one was present at their confidential meetings, and, after Piso's death, many were disposed to ingratiate themselves with the murderer. There is no doubt that the province and the troops entertained feelings of hostility to Vespasian, and some of the Vitellianists, who had escaped from the capital, incessantly represented to Piso that Gaul was hesitating and Germany ready to revolt, that his own position was perilous, and that for one who in peace must be suspected, war was the safer course. While this was going on, Claudius Sagitta, prefect of Petra's horse, making a very quick passage, reached Africa before Papirius, the centurion dispatched by Mucianus. He declared that an order to put Piso to death had been given to the centurion, and that Galerianus, his cousin and son-in-law, had perished, that his only hope of safety was in bold action, that in such action two paths were open. He might defend himself on the spot, or he might sail for Gaul and offer his services as general to the Vitellianist armies. Piso was wholly unmoved by this statement. The centurion dispatched by Mucianus, on landing in the port of Carthage, raised his voice and invoked in succession all the blessings on the head of Piso, as if he were emperor, and bade the bystanders, who were astonished by this sudden and strange proceeding, take up the same cry. The credulous mob rushed into the marketplace and demanded that Piso should show himself. They threw everything into uproar with their clamorous shouts of joy, careless of the truth and only eager to flatter. Piso, acting on the information of Sagitta, or perhaps from natural modesty, would not make his appearance in public or trust himself to the zeal of the populace. On questioning the centurion and finding that he had sought a pretext for accusing and murdering him, he ordered the man to be executed, moved not so much by any hope of saving his life as by indignation against the assassin, for this fellow had been one of the murderers of Macer, and now had come to slay the proconsul with hands already stained with the blood of the legate. He then severely blamed the people of Carthage in an edict which betrayed his anxiety, and ceased to discharge even the usual duties of his office, shutting himself up in his palace to guard against any casual occurrence which might lead to a new outbreak. But when the agitation of the people, the execution of the centurion, and other news, true or false, exaggerated as usual by report, came to the ears of Festus, he sent some cavalry to put Piso to death. They rode over at full speed, and broke into the dwelling of the proconsul in the dim light of early dawn, with their swords drawn in their hands. Many of them were unacquainted with the person of Piso, for the legate had selected some Moorish and Carthaginian auxiliaries to perpetrate the deed. Near the proconsul's chamber they chanced to meet a slave, and asked him who he was, and where Piso was to be found. The slave, with a noble untruth, replied, "I am he," and was immediately cut down. Soon after, Piso was killed, for there was on the spot one who recognized him, Bibius Massa, one of the procurators of Africa, a name even then fatal to the good, and destined often to reappear among the causes of the sufferings which he had ere long to endure. From Adrumentum, where he had stayed to watch the result, Festus went to the legion, and gave orders that Catronius Pisanus, prefect of the camp, should be put in irons. He did this out of private pique, but called the man an accomplice of Piso. Some few centurions and soldiers he punished, others he rewarded, neither the one nor the other deservedly, but he wished men to believe that he had extinguished a war. He then put an end to the quarrel between the Censis and the Lepitani, which, originating in robberies of corn and cattle on two rustic populations, had grown from this insignificant beginning till it was carried on in pitched battles. The people of Caii, who were inferior in numbers, had summoned to their aid the Garamantes, a wild race incessantly occupied in robbing their neighbors. This had brought the Lepitani to extremities. Their territory had been ravaged far and wide, and they were trembling within their walls, when the Garamantes were put to flight by the arrival of the auxiliary infantry and cavalry, and the whole of the booty was recaptured, with the exception of some which the plunderers, in their wanderings through inaccessible hamlets, had sold to more distant tribes. Vespasian had heard of the victory of Cremona, and had received favorable tidings from all quarters, and he was now informed of the fall of Vitellius by many persons of every rank, who, with a good fortune equal to their courage, risked the perils of the wintry sea. Envoys had come from King Vologesus to offer him 40,000 Parthian cavalry. It was a matter of pride and joy to him to be courted with such splendid offers of help from the allies, and not to want them. He thanked Vologesus, and recommended him to send ambassadors to the Senate, and to learn for himself that peace had been restored. While his thoughts were fixed on Italy, and on the state of the capital, he heard an unfavorable account of Domitian, which represented him as overstepping the limits of his age and the privileges of a son. He therefore entrusted Titus with the main strength of the army to complete what had yet to be done in the Jewish war. It was said that Titus, before his departure, had a long interview with his father, in which he implored him not to let himself be easily excited by the reports of slanderers, but to show an impartial and forgiving temper towards his son. Legions and fleets, he reminded him, are not such sure bulwarks of imperial power as a numerous family. As for friends, time, altered fortunes, perhaps their passions or their errors may weaken, may change, may even destroy their affection. A man's own race can never be disassociated from him, least of all with princes, whose prosperity is shared by others, while their reverses touch but their nearest kin. Even between brothers there can be no lasting affection, except the father sets the example. Vespasian, delighted with the brotherly affection of Titus, rather than reconciled to Domitian, bade his son to be of good cheer, and aggrandize the state by wars and deeds of arms. He would himself provide for the interests of the peace, and for the welfare of his family. He then had some of the swiftest vessels laden with corn, and committed them to the perils of the still, stormy sea. Rome, indeed, was in the very critical position of not having more than 10 days' consumption in the granaries, when the supplies from Vespasian arrived. The work of rebuilding the capital was assigned by him to Lucius Vestinius, a man of the equestrian order, who, however, for a high character and reputation, ranked among the nobles. The soothsayers whom he assembled directed that the remains of the old shrine should be removed to the marshes, and the new temple raised on the original site. The gods, they said, forbade the old form to be changed. On the 21st of June, beneath a cloudless sky, the entire space devoted to the sacred enclosure was encompassed with chaplets and garlands. Soldiers who bore auspicious names entered the precincts with sacred bows. Then the Vestal Virgins, with a troop of boys and girls, whose fathers and mothers were still living, sprinkled the whole space with water, drawn from the fountains and rivers. After this, Helvidius Priscus, the praetor, first purified the spot with the usual sacrifice of a sow, a sheep, and a bull, and duly placed the entrails on turf. Then, in terms dictated by Publius Aelianus, the high priest, besought Jupiter, Juno, Minerva, and the tutelar deities of the place, to prosper the undertaking, and to lend their divine help to raise the abodes which the piety of men had founded for them. He then touched the wreaths, which were wound round the foundation stone, and entwined with the ropes, while at the same moment all the other magistrates of the state, the priests, the senators, the knights, and a number of the citizens, with zeal and joy uniting their efforts, dragged the huge stone along. Contributions of gold and silver and virgin ores, never smelted in the furnace, but still in their natural state, were showered on the foundations. The soothsayers had previously directed that no stone or gold which had been intended for any other purpose should profane the work. Additional height was given to the structure. This was the only variation which religion would permit, and the one feature which had been thought wanting in the splendor of the old temple. Meanwhile, the tidings of the death of Vitellius, spreading through Gaul and Germany, had caused a second war. Civilis had thrown aside all disguise, and was now openly assailing the Roman power, while the legions of Vitellius preferred even a foreign yoke to the rule of Vespasian. Gaul had gathered fresh courage from the belief that the fortunes of our armies had been everywhere disastrous, for a report was rife that our winter camps in Moesia and Pannonia were hemmed in by the Sarmatians and Dacians. Rumors equally false were circulated respecting Britain. Above all, the conflagration of the capital had made them believe that the end of the Roman Empire was at hand. The Gauls, they remember, had captured the city in former days, but as the abode of Jupiter was uninjured, the empire had survived, whereas now, the Druids declared, with the prophetic utterances of an idle superstition, that this fatal conflagration was a sign of the anger of heaven, and portended universal empire for the transalpine nations. A rumor had also gone forth that the chiefs of Gaul, whom Otho had sent against Vitellius, had, before their departure, bound themselves by a compact not to fail the cause of freedom, should the power of Rome be broken by a continuous succession of civil wars and internal calamities. End of Book 4, Part 3.
Book 4, Part 4 of the Histories by Publius Cornelius Tacitus. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Andrew Coleman. The Histories by Publius Cornelius Tacitus. Translated by Alfred John Church and William Jackson Brodribb. Book 4. January to November AD 70. Part 4. Before the murder of Flaccus Hordionius, nothing had come out by which any conspiracy could be discovered. After his death, messengers passed to and fro between Civilis and Classicus, commander of the cavalry of the Treveri. Classicus was first among his countrymen in rank and wealth. He was of a royal house, of a race distinguished both in peace and war, and he himself claimed to be, by family tradition, the foe, rather than the ally of the Romans. Julius Tutor and Julius Sabinus joined him in his schemes. One was a Trever, the other a Lingon. Tutor had been made by Vitellius guardian of the banks of the Rhine. Sabinus, over and above his natural vanity, was inflamed with the pride of an imaginary descent, for he asserted that his great-grandmother had, by her personal charms, attracted the admiration of the divine Julius when he was campaigning in Gaul. These two men held secret conferences to sound the views of the rest of their countrymen, and when they had secured as accomplices such as they thought suitable for their purpose, they met together in a private house in the Colonia Agrippinensis, for the state in its public policy was strongly opposed to all such attempts. Some, however, of the Ubii and Tungri were present, but the Treveri and Lingones had the greatest weight in the matter, nor could they endure the delay of deliberation. They rivalled each other in vehement assertions that the Romans were in a frenzy of discord, that their legions had been cut to pieces, that Italy was laid waste, that Rome itself was at that very moment undergoing capture, while all her armies were occupied by wars of their own. if they were but to secure the passes of the Alps with bodies of troops, Gaul, with her own freedom firmly established, might look about her and fix the limits of her dominion. These views were no sooner stated than approved. As to the survivors of the Vitellianist army, they doubted what to do. Many voted for putting to death men so turbulent and faithless, stained too with the blood of their generals. Still the policy of mercy prevailed. To cut off all hope of quarter might provoke an obstinate resistance. It would be better to draw them into friendly union. If only the legates of the legions were put to death, the remaining multitude, moved by the consciousness of guilt and the hope of escape, would readily join their cause. Such was the outline of their original plan. Emissaries were likewise dispatched throughout Gaul to stir up war, while they themselves feigned submission, that they might be the better able to crush the unsuspecting Vocula. Persons, however, were found to convey information to him, but he had not sufficient strength to suppress the movement, as the legions were incomplete in numbers and disloyal. So, what with soldiers of doubtful fidelity and secret enemies, he thought it best, under the circumstances, to make his way by meeting deceit with deceit, and by using the same arts with which he was himself assailed. He therefore went down to the Colonia Agrippinensis. Thither Claudius Labio, who, as I have related, had been taken prisoner and sent out of the province into the country of the Frisii, made his escape by bribing his jailers. This man undertook, if a force were given him, to enter the Batavian territory and bring back to the Roman alliance the more influential part of that state. But, though he obtained a small force of infantry and cavalry, he did not venture to attempt anything among the Batavi, but only induced some of the Nervii and Batasii to take up arms, and made continual attacks on the Canine Fates and the Marsaci more in the way of robbery than of war. Lured on by the treacherous representations of the Gauls, Vocula marched against the enemy. He was near the old camp when Classicus and Tutor, who had gone on in advance under the pretense of reconnoitring, concluded an agreement with the German chiefs. They then for the first time separated themselves from the legions, and formed a camp of their own, with a separate line of entrenchment, while Vocula protested that the power of Rome was not so utterly shaken by civil war as to have become contemptible even to Treveri and Lingones. "There are still," he said, "faithful provinces, victorious armies, the fortune of the empire, and avenging gods." Thus it was that Sacrovir and the Aedui in former days, Vindex and the Gauls in more recent times, were crushed in a single battle. The breakers of treaties may look for the vengeance of the same deities and the same doom. Julius and Augustus understood far better the character of the people. Galba's policy and the diminution of their tribute have inspired them with hostile feelings. They are now enemies, because their yoke is easy. When they have been plundered and stripped, they will be friends. After uttering this defiance, finding that Classicus and Tutor persisted in their treachery, he changed his line of march and retired to Novaesium. The Gauls encamped at a distance of 2 miles, and plied with bribes the centurions and soldiers who visited them there, striving to make a Roman army commit the unheard of baseness of swearing allegiance to foreigners, and pledge itself to the perpetration of this atrocious crime by murdering or imprisoning its officers. Vocula, though many persons advised him to escape, thought it best to be bold, and summoning an assembly, spoke as follows: "Never, when I have addressed you, have I felt more anxious for your welfare, never more indifferent about my own. Of the destruction that threatens me I can hear with cheerfulness. And amid so many evils I look forward to death as the end of my sufferings. For you I feel shame and compassion. Against you indeed no hostile ranks are gathering. That would be but the lawful course of war, and the right which an enemy may claim. But Classicus hopes to wage with your strength his war against Rome, and proudly offers to your allegiance an empire of Gaul. Though our fortune and courage have for the moment failed us, have we so utterly forgotten the old memories of those many times when the legions of Rome resolved to perish, but not to be driven from their post? Often have our allies endured to see their cities destroyed, and with their wives and children to die in the flames, with only this reward in their death, the glory of untarnished loyalty. At this very moment, our legions at the old camp are suffering the horrors of famine and of siege, and cannot be shaken by threats or by promises. We, besides our arms, our numbers, and the singular strength of our fortifications, have corn and supplies sufficient for a campaign however protracted. We had lately money enough even to furnish a donative, and whether you choose to refer the bounty to Vitellius or Vespasian, it was at any rate from a Roman emperor that you received it. If you, who have been victorious in so many campaigns, who have so often routed the enemy at Gelduba and at the old camp, yet shrink from battle, this indeed is an unworthy fear. Still you have an entrenched camp. You have fortifications and the means of prolonging the war, till succouring armies pour in from the neighbouring provinces. It may be that I do not satisfy you. You may fall back on other legates or tribunes, on some centurion, even on some common soldier. Let not this monstrous news go forth to the whole world, that with you in their train, Civilis and Classicus are about to invade Italy. Should the Germans and the Gauls lead you to the walls of the capital, will you lift up arms against your country? My soul shudders at the imagination of so horrible a crime. Will you mount guard for Tutor the Trevor? Shall a Batavian give the signal for battle? Will you serve as recruits in the German battalions? What will be the issue of your wickedness when the Roman legions are marshalled against you? Will you be a second time deserters, a second time traitors, and breathe the anger of heaven while you waver between your old and your new allegiance? I implore and entreat thee, O Jupiter, supremely good and great, to whom through 820 years we have paid the honours of so many triumphs, and thou, Quirinus, father of Rome, that, if it be not your pleasure that this camp should be preserved pure and inviolate under my command, you will at least not suffer it to be polluted and defiled by a Tutor and a Classicus. Grant that the soldiers of Rome may either be innocent of crime, or at least experience a repentance speedy and without remorse. They received his speech with feelings that varied between hope, fear, and shame. Vocula then left them, and was preparing to put an end to his life when his freedmen and slaves prevented him from anticipating by his own act a most miserable death. Classicus dispatched one Aemilius Longinus, a deserter from the first legion, and speedily accomplished the murder. With respect to the two legates, Herennius and Numisius, it was thought enough to put them in chains. Classicus then assumed the insignia of Roman imperial power, and entered the camp. Hardened though he was to every sort of crime, he could only find words enough to go through the form of oath. All who were present swore allegiance to the empire of Gaul. He distinguished the murderer of Vocula by high promotion, and the others by rewards proportioned to their services in crime. Tutor and Classicus then divided the management of the war between them, Tutor, investing the Colonia Agrippinensis with a strong force, compelled the inhabitants and all the troops in the Upper Rhine to take the same oath. He did this after having first put to death the tribunes at Moguntiacum, and driven away the prefect of the camp, because they refused obedience. Classicus picked out all the most unprincipled men from the troops who had capitulated. and bade them go to the besieged, and offer them quarter, if they would accept the actual state of affairs. Otherwise there was no hope for them. They would have to endure famine, the sword, and the direst extremities. The messengers whom he sent supported their representations by their own example. The ties of loyalty on the one hand, and the necessities of famine on the other, kept the besieged wavering between the alternatives of glory and infamy. While they thus hesitated, all usual and even unusual kinds of food failed them, for they had consumed their horses and beasts of burden, and all the other animals, which, though unclean and disgusting, necessity compelled them to use. At last they tore up shrubs and roots, and the grass that grew between the stones, and thus showed an example of patience under privations, till at last they shamefully tarnished the lustre of their fame by sending envoys to Civilis to beg for their lives. Their prayers were not heard, till they swore allegiance to the Empire of Gaul. Civilis then stipulated for the plunder of the camp, and appointed guards who were to secure the treasure, the camp followers, and the baggage, and accompany them as they departed, stripped of everything. About 5 miles from the spot, the Germans rose upon them, and attacked them as they marched without thought of danger. The bravest were cut down where they stood, the greater part, as they were scattered in flight. The rest made their escape to the camp, while Civilis certainly complained of the proceeding, and upbraided the Germans with breaking faith by this atrocious act. Whether this was mere hypocrisy, or whether he was unable to restrain their fury, is not positively stated. They plundered, and then fired the camp, and all who survived the battle the flames destroyed. Then Civilis fulfilled a vow often made by barbarians. His hair, which he had let grow long and coloured with a red dye from the day of taking up arms against Rome, he now cut short, when the destruction of the legions had been accomplished. It was also said that he set up some of the prisoners as marks for his little son to shoot at with the child's arrows and javelins. He neither took the oath of allegiance to Gaul himself, nor obliged any Batavian to do so, for he relied on the resources of Germany, and felt that, should it be necessary to fight for empire with the Gauls, he should have on his side a great name and superior strength. Mummius Lupercus, legate of one of the legions, was sent along with other gifts to Veleda, a maiden of the tribe of the Bructeri, who possessed extensive dominion. For by ancient usage the Germans attributed to many of their women prophetic powers, and, as the superstition grew in strength, even actual divinity. The authority of Veleda was then at its height, because she had foretold the success of the Germans and the destruction of the legions. Lupercus, however, was murdered on the road. A few of the centurions and tribunes, who were natives of Gaul, were reserved as hostages for the maintenance of the alliance. The winter encampments of the auxiliary infantry and cavalry and of the legions, with the sole exception of those at Mongatiacum and Vindonissa, were pulled down and burnt. The 16th legion, with the auxiliary troops that capitulated at the same time, received orders to march from Novissium to the colony of the Treveri, a day having been fixed by which they were to quit the camp. The whole of this interval they spent in many anxious thoughts. Their cowards trembled to think of those who had been massacred at the old camp. The better men blushed with shame at the infamy of their position. "What a march is this before us!" they cried. "Who will lead us on our way? Our all is at the disposal of those whom we have made our masters for life or death." Others, without the least sense of their disgrace, stowed away about their persons their money and what else they prized most highly, while some got their arms in readiness and girded on their weapons as if for battle. While they were thus occupied, the time for their departure arrived, and proved even more dismal than their anticipation. For in their entrenchments their woeful appearance had not been so noticeable. The open plain and the light of day revealed their disgrace. The images of the emperors were torn down, the standards were borne along without their usual honours, while the banners of the Gauls glittered on every side. The train moved on in silence, like a long funeral procession. Their leader was Claudius Sanctus. One of his eyes had been destroyed. He was repulsive in countenance, and even more feeble in intellect. The guilt of the troops seemed to be doubled, when the other legion, deserting the camp at Bonna, joined their ranks. When the report of the capture of the legions became generally known, all who but a short time before trembled at the name of Rome, rushed forth from the fields and houses, and spread themselves everywhere to enjoy with extravagant delight the strange spectacle. The Picentine horse could not endure the triumph of the insulting rabble, and disregarding the promises and threats of Sanctus, rode off to Mogatiacum. Chancing to fall in with Longinus, the murderer of Vocula, they overwhelmed him with a shower of darts, and thus made a beginning towards a future expiation of their guilt. The legions did not change the direction of their march, and encamped under the walls of the colony of the Treveri. Elated with their success, Civilis and Classicus doubted whether they should not give up the Colonia Agrippinensis to be plundered by their troops. Their natural ferocity and lust for spoil prompted them to destroy the city. But the necessities of war, and the advantage of a character for clemency to men founding a new empire, forbade them to do so. Civilis was also influenced by recollections of kindness received, for his son, who at the beginning of the war had been arrested in the colony, had been kept in honourable custody. But the tribes beyond the Rhine disliked the place for its wealth and increasing power, and held that the only possible way of putting an end to war would be either to make it an open city for all Germans, or to destroy it, and so disperse the Ubii. Upon this, the Tencteri, a tribe separated by the Rhine from the colony, sent envoys with orders to make known their instructions to the Senate of the Agrippinensis. These orders the boldest spirit among the ambassadors thus expounded: "For your return into the unity of the German nation and name, we give thanks to the gods whom we worship in common and to Mars, the chief of our divinities, and we congratulate you that at length you will live as free men among the free. Up to this day have the Romans closed river and land, and, in a way, the very air, that they may bar our converse and prevent our meetings, or, what is a still worse insult to men born to arms, may force us to assemble unarmed and all but stripped, watched by sentinels and taxed for the privilege. But, that our friendship and union may be established for ever, we require of you to strip your city of its walls, which are the bulwarks of slavery. Even savage animals, if you keep them in confinement, forget their natural courage. We require of you to massacre all Romans within your territory. Liberty and a dominant race cannot well exist together. Let the property of the slain come into a common stock, so that no one may be able to secrete anything, or to detach his own interest from ours. Let it be lawful for us and for you to inhabit both banks of the Rhine, as it was of old for our ancestors. As nature has given light and air to all men, so has she thrown open every land to the brave. Resume the manners and customs of your country, renouncing the pleasures through which, rather than through their arms, the Romans secure their power against subject nations. A pure and untainted race, forgetting your past bondage, you will be the equals of all, or will even rule over others." the inhabitants of the colony took time for deliberation, and, as dread of the future would not allow them to accept the offered terms, while their actual condition forbade an open and contemptuous rejection, they replied to the following effect. The very first chance of freedom that presented itself we seized with more eagerness than caution, that we might unite ourselves with you and the other Germans, our kinsmen by blood. With respect to our fortifications, as at this very moment the Roman armies are assembling, it is safer for us to strengthen than to destroy them. All strangers from Italy or the provinces that may have been in our territory have either perished in the war or have fled to their own homes. As for those who in former days settled here and have been united to us by marriage, and as for their offspring, this is their native land. We cannot think you so unjust as to wish that we should slay our parents, our brothers, and our children. All duties and restrictions on trade we repeal. Let there be a free passage across the river, but let it be during the daytime and for persons unarmed, till the new and recent privileges assume by usage the stability of time. As arbiters between us, we will have Civilis and Velleda. Under their sanction the treaty shall be ratified. The tanctuary were thus appeased, and ambassadors were sent with presents to Civilis and Velleda, who settled everything to the satisfaction of the inhabitants of the colony. They were not, however, allowed to approach or address Velleda herself. In order to inspire them with more respect, they were prevented from seeing her. She dwelt in a lofty tower, and one of her relatives, chosen for the purpose, conveyed, like the messenger of a divinity, the questions and answers. Thus strengthened by his alliance with the Colonia Agrippinensis, Civilis resolved to attach to himself the neighbouring states, or to make war on them, if they offered any opposition. He occupied the territory of the Sunici, and formed the youth of the country into regular cohorts. To hinder his further advance, Claudius Labeo encountered him with a hastily assembled force of Batazii, Tungri, and Nervii, relying on the strength of his position, as he had occupied a bridge over the river Moser. They fought in a narrow defile without any decided result, till the Germans swam across and attacked Labio's rear. At the same moment, Civilis, acting either on some bold impulse or by a preconcerted plan, rushed into the Tungrian column, exclaiming in a loud voice, "We have not taken arms in order that the Batavi and Treveri may rule over the nations. Far from us be such arrogance. Accept our alliance. I am ready to join your ranks, whether you would prefer me to be your general or your comrade." The multitude was moved by the appeal, and were beginning to sheathe their swords, when Campanus and Juvenalis, two of the Tungrian chieftains, surrendered the whole tribe to Civilis. Labeo made his escape before he could be intercepted. The Batazii and Nervii, also capitulating, were incorporated by Civilis into his army. He now commanded vast resources, as the states were either completely cowed or else were naturally inclined in his favour. Meanwhile, Julius Sabinus, after having thrown down the pillars that recorded the treaty with Rome, bade his followers salute him as emperor, and hastened at the head of a large and undisciplined crowd of his countrymen to attack the Sequani, a neighbouring people, still faithful to Rome. The Sequani did not decline the contest. Fortune favoured the better cause, and the Ligones were defeated. Sabinus fled from the battle with a cowardice equal to the rashness with which he had precipitated it, and in order to spread a report of his death, he set fire to a country house where he had taken refuge. It was believed that he there perished by a death of his own seeking. The various shifts by which he contrived to conceal himself and to prolong his life for 9 years, the firm fidelity of his friends, and the noble example of his wife Eponina, I shall relate in their proper place. By this victory of the Sequani, the tide of war was stayed. The states began by decrees to recover their senses, and to reflect on the claims of justice and of treaties. The Remi were foremost in this movement, announcing throughout Gaul that deputies were to be sent to consult in common assembly whether they should make freedom or peace their object. At Rome, report exaggerated all these disasters, and disturbed Mucianus with the fear that the generals, though distinguished men, for he had already appointed Gallus Annius and Petilius Cerealis to the command, would be unequal to the weight of so vast a war. Yet the capital could not be left without a ruler, and men feared the ungoverned passions of Domitian, while Primus Antonius and Varus Arius were also, as I have said, objects of suspicion. Varus, who had been made commander of the Praetorian Guard, had still at his disposal much military strength. Mucianus ejected him from his office, and, not to leave him without consolation, made him superintendent of the sale of corn. To pacify the feelings of Domitian, which were not unfavourable to Varus, he appointed Aretinus Clemens, who was closely connected with the house of Vespasian, and who was also a great favourite with Domitian, to the command of the Praetorian Guard, alleging that his father, in the reign of Caligula, had admirably discharged the duties of that office. The old name, he said, would please the soldiers, and Clemens himself, though on the roll of senators, would be equal to both duties. He selected the most eminent men in the state to accompany him, while others were appointed through interest. At the same time, Domitian and Mucianus prepared to set out, but in a very different mood. Domitian in all the hope and impatience of youth, Mucianus ever contriving delays to check his ardent companion, who he feared, were he to intrude himself upon the army, might be led by the recklessness of youth or by bad advisers to compromise at once the prospects of war and of peace. Two of the victorious legions, the 6th and 8th, the 21st, which belonged to the Vitellianist army, the second, which consisted of new levies, were marched into Gaul, some over the Pennine and Cottian, some over the Graian Alps. The 14th legion was summoned from Britain, and the 6th and 10th from Spain. Thus rumours of an advancing army, as well as their own temper, inclined the states of Gaul, which assembled in the country of the Remi, to more peaceful counsels. Envoys from the treasury were awaiting them there, and among them Tullius Valentinus, the most vehement promoter of the war, who in a set speech poured forth all the charges usually made against great empires, and levelled against the Roman people many insulting and exasperating expressions. The man was a turbulent fermenter of sedition, and pleased many by his frantic eloquence. On the other hand, Julius Auspex, one of the leading chieftains among the Remi, dwelt on the power of Rome and the advantages of peace, pointing out that war might be commenced, indeed, by cowards, but must be carried on at the peril of the braver spirits. And that the Roman legions were close at hand, he restrained the most prudent by considerations of respect and loyalty, and held back the younger by representations of danger and appeals to fear. The result was that, while they extolled the spirit of Valentinus, they followed the counsels of Auspex. It is certain that the Treveri and Lingones were injured in the eyes of the Gallic nations by their having sided with Verginius in the movement of Vindex. Many were deterred by the mutual jealousy of the provinces. Where, they asked, could a head be found for the war? Where could they look for civil authority and the sanction of religion? If all went well with them, what city could they select as the seat of empire? The victory was yet to be gained. Dissension had already begun. One state angrily boasted of its alliances, another of its wealth and military strength, or of the antiquity of its origin. Disgusted with the prospect of the future, they acquiesced in their present condition. Letters were written to the Treasury in the name of the states of Gaul, requiring them to abstain from hostilities, and reminding them that pardon might yet be obtained, and that friends were ready to intercede for them, should they repent. Valentinus still opposed, and succeeded in closing the ears of his countrymen to this advice, though he was not so diligent in preparing for war as he was assiduous in haranguing. Accordingly, neither the Treveri, the Lingones, nor the other revolted states took measures at all proportioned to the magnitude of the peril they had incurred. Even their generals did not act in concert. Civilis was traversing the pathless wilds of the Belgae in attempting to capture Claudius Labio, or to drive him out of the country. Classicus, for the most part, wasted his time in indolent repose, as if he had only to enjoy an empire already won. Even Tutor made no haste to occupy with troops the upper bank of the Rhine and the passes of the Alps. Meanwhile, the 21st Legion, by way of Vindonissa, and Sextilius Felix with the auxiliary infantry by way of Rhaetia, penetrated into the province. They were joined by the Singularian horse, which had been raised some time before by Vitellius, and had afterwards gone over to the side of Vespasian. Their commanding officer was Julius Briganticus. He was sister's son to Civilis, and he was hated by his uncle, and hated him in return with all the extreme bitterness of a family feud. Tutor, having augmented the army of the Treveri with fresh levies from the Vangiones, the Caracates, and the Triboci, strengthened it with a force of veteran infantry and cavalry. Men from the legions, whom he had either corrupted by promises or overborne by intimidation. Their first act was to cut to pieces a cohort, which had been sent on in advance by Sextilius Felix. Soon afterwards, however, on the approach of the Roman generals at the head of their army, they returned to their duty by an act of honourable desertion, and the Triboci, Vangiones, and Caracates followed their example. Avoiding Mongatiacum, Tutor retired with the Treveri to Bingium, trusting to the strength of the position, as he had broken down the bridge of the river Nava. A sudden attack, however, was made by the infantry under the command of Sextilius. A ford was discovered, and he found himself betrayed and routed. The Treveri were panic-stricken by this disaster, and the common people threw down their arms and dispersed themselves through the country. Some of the chiefs, anxious to seem the first to cease from hostilities, fled to those states which had not renounced the Roman alliance. The legions which had been removed, as I have before related, from Novicium and Bonner to the territory of the Treveri, voluntarily swore allegiance to Vespasian. These proceedings took place in the absence of Valentinus. When he returned, full of fury and bent on again throwing everything into confusion and ruin, the legions withdrew to the Mediomatrici, a people in alliance with Rome. Valentinus and Tutor again involved the Treveri in war, and murdered the two legates, Herennius and Numisius, that by diminishing the hope of pardon, they might strengthen the bond of crime. End of Book 4, Part 4. Book 4, Part 5 of the Histories, by Publius Cornelius Tacitus. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Andrew Coleman. The Histories by Publius Cornelius Tacitus. Translated by Alfred John Church and William Jackson Brodribb. Book 4. January to November AD 70. Part 5. Such was the state of the war when Petilius Cerealis reached Mongatiacum. Great expectations were raised by his arrival. Eager for battle, and more ready to despise than to be on his guard against the enemy, he fired the spirit of the troops by his bold language. For he would, he said, fight without a moment's delay, as soon as it was possible to meet the foe. The levies which had been raised in Gaul he ordered back to their respective states, with instructions to proclaim that the legions sufficed to defend the empire, and that the allies might return to the duties of peace, secure in the thought that a war which Roman arms had undertaken was finished. This proceeding strengthened the loyalty of the Gauls. Now that their youth were restored to them, they could more easily bear the burden of the tribute, and finding themselves despised, they were more ready to obey. Civilis and Classicus, having heard of the defeat of Tutor and of the rout of the Treveri, and indeed of the complete success of the enemy, hastened in their alarm to concentrate their own scattered forces, and meanwhile sent repeated messages to Valentinus, warning him not to risk a decisive battle. This made Cerealis move with more rapidity. He sent to the Mediomatrici persons commissioned to conduct the legions which were there by the shortest route against the enemy, and, collecting such troops as there were at Mongatiacum, and such as he had brought with himself, he arrived in 3 days' march at Rigodulum. Valentinus, at the head of a large body of Treveri, had occupied this position, which was protected by hills, and by the river Mosella. He had also strengthened it with ditches and breastworks of stones. These defences, however, did not deter the Roman general from ordering his infantry to the assault, and making his cavalry advance up the hill. He scorned the enemy, whose forces hastily levied could not, he knew, derive any advantage from their position, but what would be more than counterbalanced by the courage of his own men. There was some little delay in the ascent, while the troops were passing through the range of the enemy's missiles. As soon as they came to close fighting, the barbarians were dislodged and hurled like a falling house from their position. A detachment of the cavalry rode round where the hills were less steep, and captured the principal Belgic chiefs, and among them Valentinus, their general. On the following day, Cerealis entered the colony of the Treveri. The soldiers were eager to destroy the city. "This," they said, "is the birthplace of Classicus and Tutor. It was by the treason of these men that our legions were besieged and massacred. What had Cremona done like this? Cremona, which was torn from the very bosom of Italy, because it had occasioned the conquerors the delay of a single night. Here, on the borders of Germany, stands unharmed a city which exults in the spoils of our armies and the blood of our generals. Let the plunder be brought into the imperial treasury. We shall be satisfied with a fire that will destroy a rebellious colony, and compensate for the overthrow of so many camps." Cerealis, fearing the disgrace of being thought to have imbued his soldiers with a spirit of license and cruelty, checked their fury. They submitted, for, now that civil war was at an end, they were tractable enough in dealing with an enemy. Their thoughts were then diverted by the pitiable aspect of the legions which had been summoned from the Mediomatrici. They stood oppressed by the consciousness of guilt, their eyes fixed on the earth. No friendly salutations passed between the armies as they met. They made no answer to those who would console or encourage them, but hid themselves in their tents, and shrank from the very light of day. Nor was it so much their peril or their alarm that confounded them, as their shame and humiliation. Even the conquerors were struck dumb, and dared not utter a word of entreaty, but pleaded for pardon by their silent tears, till Cerealis at last soothed their minds by declaring that destiny had brought about all that had happened through the discords of soldiers and generals, or through the treachery of the foe. They must consider that day as the first of their military service and of their allegiance. Their past crimes would be remembered neither by the emperor nor by himself. They were thus admitted into the same camp with the rest, and an order was read in every company that no soldier was in any contention or altercation to reproach a comrade with mutiny or defeat. Cerealis then convoked an assembly of the Treveri and Lingones, and thus addressed them: "I have never cultivated eloquence. It is by my sword that I have asserted the excellence of the Roman people. Since, however, words have very great weight with you, since you estimate good and evil, not according to their real value, but according to the representations of seditious men, I have resolved to say a few words, which, as the war is at an end, it may be useful for you to have heard, rather than for me to have spoken. Roman generals and emperors entered your territory, as they did the rest of Gaul, with no ambitious purposes, but at the solicitation of your ancestors, who were wearied to the last extremity by intestine strife, while the Germans, whom they had summoned to their help, had imposed their yoke alike on friend and foe. How many battles we have fought against the Cimbri and Teutones, at the cost of what hardships to our armies, and with what result we have waged our German wars, is perfectly well known. It was not to defend Italy that we occupied the borders of the Rhine, but to ensure that no second Ariovistus should seize the empire of Gaul. Do you fancy yourselves to be dearer in the eyes of Civilis and the Batavi and the Transrhenane tribes than your fathers and grandfathers were to their ancestors? There have ever been the same causes at work to make the Germans cross over into Gaul: lust, avarice, and the longing for a new home, prompting them to leave their own marshes and deserts, and to possess themselves of this most fertile soil, and of you, its inhabitants. Liberty indeed, and the like specious names, are their pretexts. But never did any man seek to enslave his fellows and secure dominion for himself without using the very same words. Gaul always had its petty kingdoms and intestine wars, till you submitted to our authority. We, though so often provoked, have used the right of conquest to burden you only with the cost of maintaining peace. For the tranquillity of nations cannot be preserved without armies. Armies cannot exist without pay. Pay cannot be furnished without tribute. All else is common between us. You often command our legions. You rule these and other provinces. There is no privilege, no exclusion. From worthy emperors you derive equal advantage, though you dwell so far away, while cruel rulers are most formidable to their neighbours. Endure the passions and rapacity of your masters, just as you bear barren seasons and excessive rains and other natural evils. There will be vices as long as there are men, but they are not perpetual, and they are compensated by the occurrence of better things. Perhaps, however, you expect a milder rule under Tutor and Classicus, and fancy that armies to repel the Germans and the Britons will be furnished by less tribute than you now pay. Should the Romans be driven out, which God forbid, what can result but wars between all these nations? By the prosperity and order of 800 years has this fabric of empire been consolidated, nor can it be overthrown without destroying those who overthrow it. Yours will be the worst peril, for you have gold and wealth, and these are the chief incentives to war. Give therefore your love and respect to the cause of peace, and to the capital in which we, conquerors and conquered, claim an equal right. Let the lessons of fortune in both its forms teach you not to prefer rebellion and ruin to submission and safety. With words to this effect, he quieted and encouraged his audience, who feared harsher treatment. The territory of the Treveri was occupied by the victorious army, when Civilis and Classicus sent letters to Cerialis, the purport of which was as follows: Vespasian, though the news is suppressed, is dead. Rome and Italy are thoroughly wasted by intestine war. Mucianus and Domitian are mere empty and powerless names. If Cerialis wishes for the empire of Gaul, we can be content with the boundaries of our own states. If he prefers to fight, we do not refuse that alternative." Cerialis sent no answer to Civilis and Classicus, but dispatched the bearer and the letter itself to Domitian. The enemy advanced from every quarter in several bodies. Cerialis was generally censured for allowing them to unite when he might have destroyed them in detail. The Roman army surrounded their camp with a fosse and rampart, for up to that time they had been rash enough to occupy it without any defence. Among the Germans there was a conflict of opinions. Civilis said, "We must await the arrival of the Transrhenane tribes, the terror of whose name will break down the shattered strength of Rome. As for the Gauls, what are they but the prey of the conqueror? And yet the chief strength of the nation, the Belgae, are with us, either openly or in heart." Tutor maintained that the power of Rome would only increase with delay, as her armies were assembling from all quarters. "One legion," he said, "has already been brought over from Britain. Others have been summoned from Spain, or are advancing from Italy. Nor are these troops newly raised levies, but they are veteran soldiers experienced in war. But the Germans, whom we are expecting, do not obey orders and cannot be controlled, but always act according to their own caprice. The money, too, and other presents by which alone they can be bribed are more plentiful among the Romans, and no one can be so bent on fighting as not to prefer repose to peril when the profit is the same. But if we at once meet the foe, Cerialis has no legions but those that survive from the wreck of the German army, and these are bound by treaties to the states of Gaul. And the very fact of their having, contrary to their expectations, lately routed the undisciplined force of Valentinus, will confirm in their rashness both them and their general. They will venture again, and will find themselves in the hands, not of an ignorant stripling, whose thoughts were of speeches and harangues rather than of battle and the sword, but in those of Civilis and Classicus, whom when they once behold, they will be reminded of panic, of flight, of famine, and of the many times when as captives they had to beg for life. Nor are the Treveri and Lingones bound by any ties of affection. Once let their fear cease, and they will resume their arms." Classicus put an end to these differences of opinion by giving his approval to the suggestions of Tutor, which were at once acted on. The centre was the post assigned to the Ubii and Lingones. On the right were the Batavian cohorts, on the left the Bructeri and the Tencteri, one division marching over the hills, another passing between the high road and the river Mosella, made the attack with such suddenness that Cerialis, who had not slept in the camp, was in his chamber and even in his bed, when he heard at the same moment that the battle had begun and that his men were being worsted. He rebuked the alarm of the messengers, till the whole extent of the disaster became visible, and he saw that the camp of the legions had been forced, that the cavalry were routed, that the bridge over the Mosella, which connected the further bank of the river with the colony, was held by the Germans. Undismayed by the confusion, Cerialis held back the fugitives with his own hand, and readily exposing himself, with his person entirely unprotected, to the missiles of the enemy, he succeeded by a daring and successful effort, with the prompt aid of his bravest soldiers, in recovering the bridge and holding it with a picked force. Then returning to the camp, he saw the broken companies of the legions, which had been captured at Bonna and Novesium, with but few soldiers round the standards, and the eagles all but surrounded by the foe. Fired with indignation, he exclaimed, "It is not Flaccus or Vocula whom you are thus abandoning. There is no treachery here. I have nothing to excuse, but that I rashly believe that you, forgetting your alliance with Gaul, had again recollected your allegiance to Rome. I shall be added to the number of the Numisii and Herennii, so that all your commanders will have fallen by the hands of their soldiers or of the enemy. Go tell Vespasian, or since they are nearer, Civilis and Classicus, that you have deserted your general on the battlefield. Legions will come, who will not leave me unavenged or you unpunished." All this was true, and the tribunes and prefects heaped on their men the same reproaches. The troops formed themselves in cohorts and companies, for they could not deploy into line, as the enemy were scattered everywhere, while from the fact that the battle was raging within the entrenchments, they were themselves hampered with their tents and baggage. Tutor, Classicus, and Civilis, each at his post, animated the combatants. The Gauls they urged to fight for freedom, the Batavi for glory, the Germans for plunder. Everything seemed in favour of the enemy, till the 21st Legion, having more room than the others, formed itself into a compact body, withstood, and soon drove back the assailants. Nor was it without an interposition of heaven, that by a sudden change of temper the conquerors turned their backs and fled. Their own account was that they were alarmed by the sight of the cohorts, which, after being broken at the first onset, rallied on the top of the hills, and presented the appearance of reinforcements. What checked them in their course of victory was a mischievous struggle among themselves to secure plunder while they forgot the enemy. Cerialis, having thus all but ruined everything by his carelessness, restored the day by his resolution. Following up his success, he took and destroyed the enemy's camp on the same day. No long time was allowed to the soldiers for repose. The Agrippinenses were begging for help, and were offering to give up the wife and sister of Civilis and the daughter of Classicus, who had been left with them as pledges for the maintenance of the alliance. In the meanwhile, they had massacred all the Germans who were scattered throughout their dwellings. Hence their alarm and reasonable importunity in begging for help, before the enemy, recovering their strength, could raise their spirits for a new effort or for thoughts of revenge. And indeed Civilis had marched in their direction, nor was he by any means weak, as he had still, in unbroken force, the most warlike of his cohorts, which consisted of Chauci and Frisii, and which was posted at Obiacum, on the frontiers of the Agrippinenses. He was, however, diverted from his purpose by the deplorable news that this cohort had been entirely destroyed by a stratagem of the Agrippinenses, who, having stupefied the Germans by a profuse entertainment and abundance of wine, fastened the doors, set fire to the houses, and burned them. At the same time, Cerialis advanced by forced marches and relieved the city. Civilis, too, was beset by other fears. He was afraid that the 14th Legion, supported by the fleet from Britain, might do mischief to the Batavi along their line of coast. The Legion was, however, marched overland under the command of Fabius Priscus into the territory of the Nervian Tungri, and these two states were allowed to capitulate. The Canine Fates, taking the offensive, attacked our fleet, and the larger part of the ships was either sunk or captured. The same tribe also routed a crowd of Nervii, who by a spontaneous movement had taken up arms on the Roman side. Classicus also gained a victory over some cavalry, who had been sent on to Novissium by Cerialis. These reverses, which though trifling, came in rapid succession, destroyed by degrees the prestige of the recent victory. About the same time, Mucianus ordered the son of Vitellius to be put to death, alleging that dissension would never cease if he did not destroy all seeds of civil war. Nor would he suffer Antonius Primus to be taken into the number of Domitian's attendants, for he felt uneasy at his popularity with the troops, and feared the proud spirit of the man, who could not endure an equal, much less a superior. Antonius then went to Vespasian, who received him, not indeed as he expected, but in a not unfriendly spirit. Two opposite influences acted on the emperor. On the one hand were the merits of Antonius, under whose conduct the war had beyond all doubt been terminated. On the other were the letters of Mucianus. And everyone else inveighed against him as an ill-affected and conceited man, nor did they forget the scandals of his early life. Antonius himself failed not to provoke offence by his arrogance and his excessive propensity to dwell on his own services. He reproached other men with being cowards. Caecina he stigmatized as a captive and a prisoner of war. Thus by degrees he came to be thought of less weight and worth, though his friendship with the emperor, to all appearance, remained the same. In the months during which Vespasian was waiting at Alexandria for the periodical return of the summer gales and settled weather at sea, many wonders occurred which seemed to point him out as the object of the favour of heaven and of the partiality of the gods. One of the common people of Alexandria, well known for his blindness, threw himself at the emperor's knees and implored him with groans to heal his infirmity. This he did by the advice of the god Serapis, whom this nation, devoted as it is to many superstitions, worships more than any other divinity. He begged Vespasian that he would deign to moisten his cheeks and eyeballs with his spittle. Another, with a diseased hand, at the counsel of the same god, prayed that the limb might feel the print of a Caesar's foot. At first Vespasian ridiculed and repulsed them. They persisted, and he, though on the one hand he feared the scandal of a fruitless attempt, yet on the other was induced by the entreaties of the men and by the language of his flatterers to hope for success. At last he ordered that the opinion of physicians should be taken as to whether such blindness and infirmity were within the reach of human skill. They discussed the matter from different points of view. In the one case, they said, the faculty of sight was not wholly destroyed, and might return if the obstacles were removed. In the other case, the limb, which had fallen into a diseased condition, might be restored if a healing influence were applied. Such perhaps might be the pleasure of the gods, and the emperor might be chosen to be the minister of the divine will. At any rate, all the glory of a successful remedy would be Caesar's, while the ridicule of failure would fall on the sufferers. And so Vespasian, supposing that all things were possible to his good fortune, and that nothing was any longer past belief, with a joyful countenance, amid the intense expectation of the multitude of bystanders, accomplished what was required. The hand was instantly restored to its use, and the light of day again shone upon the blind. Persons actually present attest both facts, even now, when nothing is to be gained by falsehood. Vespasian thus came to conceive a deeper desire to visit the sanctuary of Serapis, that he might consult the god about the interests of his throne. He gave orders that all persons should be excluded from the temple. He had entered, and was absorbed in worship, when he saw behind him one of the chief men of Egypt, named Basilides, whom he knew at the time to be detained by sickness at a considerable distance, as much as several days' journey from Alexandria. He inquired of the priests whether Basilides had on this day entered the temple. He inquired of others whom he met whether he had been seen in the city. At length, sending some horsemen, he ascertained that at that very instant the man had been 80 miles distant. He then concluded that it was a divine apparition, and discovered an oracular force in the name of Basilides. The origin of this god Serapis has not hitherto been made generally known by our writers. The Egyptian priests give this account. While Ptolemy, the first Macedonian king, who consolidated the power of Egypt, was setting up in the newly built city of Alexandria fortifications, temples, and rites of worship, there appeared to him in his sleep a youth of singular beauty and more than human stature, who counselled the monarch to send his most trusty friends to Pontus and fetch his effigy from that country. This, he said, would bring prosperity to the realm, and great and illustrious would be the city which gave it a reception. At the same moment he saw the youth ascend to heaven in a blaze of fire. Roused by so significant and strange an appearance, Ptolemy disclosed the vision of the night to the Egyptian priests, whose business it is to understand such matters. As they knew but little of Pontus or of foreign countries, he inquired of Timotheus, an Athenian, one of the family of the Eumolpids, whom he had invited from Eleusis to preside over the sacred rites, what this worship was, and who was the deity. Timotheus, questioning persons who had found their way to Pontus, learnt that there was a city Sinope, and near it a temple, which according to an old tradition of the neighbourhood, was sacred to the infernal Jupiter, for there also stood close at hand a female figure, to which many gave the name of Proserpine. Ptolemy, however, with a true disposition of a despot, though prone to alarm, was, when the feeling of security returned, more intent on pleasures than on religious matters, and he began by degrees to neglect the affair, and to turn his thoughts to other concerns, till at length the same apparition, but now more terrible and peremptory, denounced ruin against the king and his realm, unless his bidding were performed. Ptolemy then gave directions that an embassy should be dispatched with presents to King Scyrothemis, who at that time ruled the people of Sinope, and instructed them, when they were on the point of sailing, to consult the Pythian Apollo. Their voyage was prosperous, and the response of the oracle was clear. The god bade them go and carry back with them the image of his father, but leave that of his sister behind. On their arrival at Sinope, they delivered to Scyrothemis the presents from their king, with his request and message. He wavered in purpose, dreading at one moment the anger of the god, terrified at another by the threats and opposition of the people. Often he was wrought upon by the gifts and promises of the ambassadors. And so 3 years passed away, while Ptolemy did not cease to urge his zealous solicitations. He continued to increase the dignity of his embassies, the number of his ships, and the weight of his gold. A terrible vision then appeared to Scyrothemis, warning him to thwart no longer the purposes of the god. As he yet hesitated, various disasters, pestilence, and the unmistakable anger of heaven, which grew heavier from day to day, continued to harass him. He summoned an assembly, and explained to them the bidding of the god, the visions of Ptolemy and himself, and the miseries that were gathering about them. The people turned away angrily from their king, were jealous of Egypt, and fearing for themselves, thronged around the temple. The story becomes at this point more marvellous, and relates that the god of his own will conveyed himself on board the fleet, which had been brought close to shore, and, wonderful to say, vast as was the extent of sea that they traversed, they arrived at Alexandria on the third day. A temple, proportioned to the grandeur of the city, was erected in a place called Rakotis, where there had stood a chapel consecrated in old times to Serapis and Isis. Such is the most popular account of the origin and introduction of the god Serapis. I am aware, indeed, that there are some who say that he was brought from Seleucia, a city of Syria, in the reign of Ptolemy III, while others assert that it was the act of the same king, but that the place from which he was brought was Memphis, once a famous city, and the strength of ancient Egypt. The god himself, because he heals the sick, many identified with Aesculapius, others with Osiris, the deity of the highest antiquity among these nations, not a few with Jupiter, as being supreme ruler of all things, but most people with Pluto, arguing from the emblems which may be seen on his statues, or from conjectures of their own. Domitian and Mucianus received, before they reached the Alps, favourable news of the operations among the Treveri. The best proof of the victory was seen in the enemy's general Valentinus, who, with undaunted courage, showed in his look his habitual high spirit. He was heard, but only that they might judge of his character, and he was condemned. During his execution he replied to one who taunted him with the subjection of his country, "That I take as my consolation in death." Mucianus now brought forward as a new thought a plan he had long concealed. "Since," he said, "by the blessing of the gods the strength of the enemy has been broken, it would little become Domitian, now that the war is all but finished, to interfere with the glory of others. If the stability of the empire or the safety of Gaul were in danger, it would have been right for Caesar to take his place in the field, but the Canine Fates and Batavi should be handed over to inferior generals. Let the emperor display from the near neighbourhood of Lugdunum the might and prestige of imperial power, not meddling with trifling risks, though he would not be wanting on greater occasions." His artifices were understood, but it was a part of their respect not to expose them. Thus they arrived at Lugdunum. It is believed that from this place Domitian dispatched secret emissaries to Cerialis, and tempted his loyalty with the question whether, on his showing himself, he would hand over to him the command of the army. Whether in this scheme Domitian was thinking of war with his father, or of collecting money and men to be used against his brother, was uncertain. For Cerialis, by a judicious temporizing, eluded the request as prompted by an idle and childish ambition. Domitian, seeing that his youth was despised by the older officers, gave up even the less important functions of government which he had before exercised. Under a semblance of simple and modest tastes, he wrapped himself in a profound reserve, and affected a devotion to literature and a love of poetry, thus seeking to throw a veil over his character, and to withdraw himself from the jealousy of his brother, of whose milder temper, so unlike his own, he judged most falsely. End of Book 4, Part 5.
Book 5, Part 1 of the Histories by Publius Cornelius Tacitus. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Linny. The Histories by Publius Cornelius Tacitus, translated by Alfred John Church and William Jackson Brodrip. Book 5, AD 70, Part 1. Early in this year, Titus Caesar, who had been selected by his father to complete the subjugation of Judea, and who had gained distinction as a soldier while both were still subjects, began to rise in power and reputation, as armies and provinces emulated each other in their attachment to him. The young man himself, anxious to be thought superior to his station, was ever displaying his gracefulness and his energy in war. By his courtesy and affability, he called forth a willing obedience, and he often mixed with the common soldiers while working or marching, without impairing his dignity as general. He found in Judea 3 legions, the 5th, the 10th, and the 15th, all old troops of Vespasian's. To these he added the 12th, from Syria, and some men belonging to the 18th and 3rd, whom he had withdrawn from Alexandria. This force was accompanied by 20 cohorts of allied troops, and 8 squadrons of cavalry, by the 2 kings Agrippa and Sohemus, by the auxiliary forces of King Antiochus, by a strong contingent of Arabs, who hated the Jews with the usual hatred of neighbors, and, lastly, by many persons brought from the capital and from Italy by private hopes of securing the yet unengaged affections of the prince. With this force, Titus entered the enemy's territory, preserving strict order on his march, reconnoitering every spot, and always ready to give battle. At last, he encamped near Jerusalem. As I am about to relate the last days of a famous city, it seems appropriate to throw some light on its origin. Some say that the Jews were fugitives from the island of Crete, who settled on the nearest coast of Africa about the time when Saturn was driven from his throne by the power of Jupiter. Evidence of this is sought in the name. There is a famous mountain in Crete called Ida. The neighboring tribe, the Idaei, came to be called Judaei by a barbarous lengthening of the national name. Others assert that in the reign of Isis, the overflowing population of Egypt, led by Hierosolymus and Judas, discharged itself into the neighboring countries. Many again say that they were a race of Ethiopian origin, who, in the time of King Cepheus, were driven by fear and hatred of their neighbors to seek a new dwelling place. Others describe them as an Assyrian horde, who, not having sufficient territory, took possession of part of Egypt, and founded cities of their own in what is called the Hebrew country, lying on the borders of Syria. Others again assign a very distinguished origin to the Jews, alleging that they were the Solymi, a nation celebrated in the poems of Homer, who called the city which they founded Hierosolyma, after their own name. Most writers, however, agree in stating that, once a disease, which horribly disfigured the body, broke out over Egypt, that King Bocchaeus, seeking a remedy, consulted the oracle of Haman, and was bidden to cleanse his realm, and to convey into some foreign land this race detested by the gods. The people, who had been collected after diligent search, finding themselves left in a desert, sat for the most part in a stupor of grief, till one of the exiles, Moses by name, warned them not to look for any relief from God or men, forsaken as they were of both, but to trust to themselves, taking for their heaven-sent leader that man who should first help them to be quit of their present misery. They agreed, and in utter ignorance began to advance at random. Nothing, however, distressed them so much as the scarcity of water, and they had sunk ready to perish in all directions over the plain, when a herd of wild asses was seen to retire from their pasture to a rock shaded by trees. Moses followed them, and guided by the appearance of a grassy spot, discovered an abundant spring of water. This furnished relief. After a continuous journey for 6 days, on the seventh they possessed themselves of a country, from which they expelled the inhabitants, and in which they founded a city and a temple. Moses, wishing to secure for the future his authority over the nation, gave them a novel form of worship, opposed to all that is practiced by other men. Things sacred with us, with them have no sanctity, while they allow what with us is forbidden. In their holy place they have consecrated an image of the animal, by whose guidance they found deliverance from their long and thirsty wanderings. They slay the ram, seemingly in derision of Haman, as they sacrifice the ox, because the Egyptians worship it as Apis. They abstain from swine's flesh, in consideration of what they suffered when they were inflicted by the leprosy to which this animal is liable. By their frequent fasts, they still bear witness to the long hunger of former days, and the Jewish bread, made without leaven, is retained as a memorial of their hurried seizure of corn. We are told that the rest of the seventh day was adopted because this day brought with it a termination of their toils. After a while, the charm of indolence beguiled them into giving up the seventh year also to inaction. But others say that it is an observance in honor of Saturn, either from the primitive elements of their faith having been transmitted from the Aedai, who are said to have shared the flight of that god, and to have founded the race, or from the circumstance that, of the seven stars which rule the destinies of men, Saturn moves in the highest orbit, and with the mightiest power, and that many of the heavenly bodies complete their revolutions and courses in multiples of seven. This worship, however introduced, is upheld by its antiquity. All their other customs, which are at once perverse and disgusting, owe their strength to their very badness. The most degraded out of other races, scorning their national beliefs, brought to them their contributions and presents. This augmented the wealth of the Jews, as also did the fact that among themselves they are inflexibly honest and ever ready to shew compassion, though they regard the rest of mankind with all the hatred of enemies. They sit apart at meals, they sleep apart, and though, as a nation, they are singularly prone to lust, they abstain from intercourse with foreign women. Among themselves nothing is unlawful. Circumcision was adopted by them as a mark of difference from other men. Those who come over to their religion adopt the practice, and have this lesson first instilled into them, to despise all gods, to disown their country, and set at naught parents, children, and brethren. Still, they provide for the increase of their numbers. It is a crime among them to kill any newly born infant. They hold that the souls of all who perish in battle or by the hands of the executioner are immortal. Hence, a passion for propagating their race and a contempt for death. They are wont to bury rather than to burn their dead, following in this the Egyptian custom. They bestow the same care on the dead, and they hold the same belief about the lower world. Quite different is their faith about things divine. The Egyptians worship many animals and images of monstrous form. The Jews have purely mental conceptions of deity, as one in essence. They call those profane who make representations of God in human shape out of perishable materials. They believe that being, to be supreme and eternal, neither capable of representation nor of decay. They, therefore, do not allow any images to stand in their cities, much less in their temples. This flattery is not paid to their kings, nor dishonor to our emperors. From the fact, however, that their priests used to chant to the music of flutes and cymbals, and to wear garlands of ivy, and that a golden vine was found in the temple, some have thought that they worshipped Father Liber, the conqueror of the East, though their institutions do not by any means harmonize with the theory, for Liber established a festive and cheerful worship, while the Jewish religion is tasteless and mean. Eastward, the country is bounded by Arabia. To the south lies Egypt. On the west are Phoenicia and the Mediterranean. Northward, it commands an extensive prospect over Syria. The inhabitants are healthy and able to bear fatigue. Rain is uncommon, but the soil is fertile. Its products resemble our own. They have, besides, the balsam tree and the palm. The palm groves are tall and graceful. The balsam is a shrub. Each branch, as it fills with sap, may be pierced with a fragment of stone or pottery. If steel is employed, the veins shrink up. The sap is used by physicians. Libanus is the principal mountain, and has, strange to say, amidst these burning heats, a summit shaded with trees and never deserted by its snows. The same range supplies and sends forth the stream of the Jordan. This river does not discharge itself into the sea, but flows entire through two lakes and is lost in the third. This is a lake of vast circumference. It resembles the sea, but is more nauseous in taste. It breeds pestilence among those who live nearby its noisome odor. It cannot be moved by the wind, and it affords no home either to fish or water birds. These strange waters support what is thrown upon them, as on a solid surface, and all persons, whether they can swim or no, are equally buoyed up by the waves. At a certain season of the year, the lake throws up bitumen, and the method of collecting it has been taught by that experience which teaches all other arts. It is naturally a fluid of dark color. When vinegar is sprinkled upon it, it coagulates and floats upon the surface. Those whose business it is take it with the hand and draw it on to the deck of the boat. It then continues of itself to flow in and lave the vessel till the stream is cut off. Nor can this be done by any instrument of brass or iron. It shrinks from blood or any cloth stained by the menstrual of women. Such is the account of old authors, but those who know the country say that the bitumen moves in heaving masses on the water, that it is drawn by hand to the shore, and that there, when dried up by the evaporation of the earth and the power of the sun, it is cut into pieces with axes and wedges, just as timber or stone would be. Not far from this lake lies a plain, once fertile, they say, and the site of great cities, but afterwards struck by lightning and consumed. Of this event, they declare, traces still remain, for the soil, which is scorched in appearance, has lost its productive power. Everything that grows spontaneously, as well as what is planted by hand, either when the leaf or flower have been developed, or after maturing in the usual form, becomes black and rotten, and crumbles into a kind of dust. I am ready to allow, on the one hand, that cities once famous may have been consumed by fire from heaven, while, on the other, I imagine that the earth is infected by the exhalations of the lake, that the surrounding air is tainted, and that thus the growth of harvest and the fruits of autumn decay under the equally noxious influences of soil and climate. The river Belus also flows into the Jewish sea. About its mouth is a kind of sand, which is collected, mixed with nitre, and fused into glass. The shore is of limited extent, but furnishes an inexhaustible supply to the exporter. A great part of Judea consists of scattered villages. They have also towns. Jerusalem is the capital. There stood a temple of immense wealth. First came the city with its fortifications, then the royal palace, then, within the innermost defenses, the temple itself. Only the Jew might approach the gates. all but priests were forbidden to pass the threshold. While the East was under the sway of the Assyrians, the Medes, and the Persians, Jews were the most contemptible of the subject tribes. When the Macedonians became supreme, King Antiochus strove to destroy the national superstition and to introduce Greek civilization, but was prevented by his war with the Parthians from at all improving the vilest of nations. For at this time the revolt of Arsaces had taken place. The Macedonian power was now weak, while the Parthian had not yet reached its full strength. And, as the Romans were still far off, the Jews chose kings for themselves. Expelled by the fickle populace, and regaining their throne by force of arms, these princes, while they ventured on the wholesale banishment of their subjects, on the destruction of cities, on the murder of brothers, wives, and parents, and the other usual atrocities of despots, fostered the national superstition by appropriating the dignity of the priesthood as the support of their political power. Gnaeus Pompeius was the first of our countrymen to subdue the Jews. Availing himself of the right of conquest, he entered the temple. Thus, it became commonly known that the place stood empty with no similitude of gods within, and that the shrine had nothing to reveal. The walls of Jerusalem were destroyed. The temple was left standing. After these provinces had fallen, in the course of our civil wars, into the hands of Marcus Antonius, Pacorus, king of the Parthians, seized Judea. He was slain by Publius Ventidius, and the Parthians were driven back over the Euphrates. Caius Sosius reduced the Jews to subjection. The royal power, which had been bestowed by Antony on Herod, was augmented by the victorious Augustus. On Herod's death, one Simon, without waiting for the approbation of the emperor, usurped the title of king. He was punished by Quintilius Varus, then governor of Syria, and the nation, with its liberties curtailed, was divided into three provinces under the sons of Herod. Under Tiberius, all was quiet. But when the Jews were ordered by Caligula to set up his statue in the temple, they preferred the alternative of war. The death of the emperor put an end to the disturbance. The kings were either dead or reduced to insignificance when Claudius entrusted the province of Judea to the Roman knights or to his own freedmen, one of whom, Antonius Felix, indulging in every kind of barbarity and lust, exercised the power of a king in the spirit of a slave. He had married Drusilla, the granddaughter of Antony and Cleopatra, and so was the grandson-in-law, as Claudius was the grandson of Antony. Yet, the endurance of the Jews lasted till Gessius Florus was procurator. In his time, the war broke out. Cestius Gallus, legate of Syria, who attempted to crush it, had to fight several battles, generally with ill success. Cestius dying, either in the course of nature or from vexation, Vespasian was sent by Nero, and by help of his good fortune, his high reputation, and his excellent subordinates, succeeded within the space of 2 summers in occupying with his victorious army the whole of the level country and all the cities, except Jerusalem. The following year had been wholly taken up with civil strife, and had passed, as far as the Jews were concerned, in inaction. Peace having been established in Italy, foreign affairs were once more remembered. Our indignation was heightened by the circumstance that the Jews alone had not submitted. At the same time, it was held to be more expedient, in reference to the possible results and contingencies of the new reign, that Titus should remain with the army. Accordingly, he pitched his camp, as I have related, before the walls of Jerusalem, and displayed his legions in order of battle. The Jews formed their line close under their walls, whence, if successful, they might venture to advance, and where, if repulsed, they had a refuge at hand. The cavalry, with some light infantry, was sent to attack them, and fought without any decisive result. Shortly afterwards, the enemy retreated. During the following days they fought a series of engagements in front of the gates, till they were driven within the walls by continual defeats. The Romans then began to prepare for an assault. It seemed beneath them to await the result of famine. The army demanded the more perilous alternative, some prompted by courage, many by sheer ferocity and greed of gain. Titus himself had Rome, with all its wealth and pleasures, before his eyes. Jerusalem must fall at once, or it would delay his enjoyment of them. But the commanding situation of the city had been strengthened by enormous works which would have been a thorough defense even for level ground. Two hills of great height were fenced in by walls which had been skillfully oblique or bent inwards, in such a manner that the flank of an assailant was exposed to missiles. The rock terminated in a precipice. The towers were raised to a height of 60 feet, where the hill lent its aid to the fortifications, where the ground fell, to a height of 120. They had a marvelous appearance, and to a distant spectator seemed to be of uniform elevation. Within were other walls surrounding the palace, and, rising to a conspicuous height, the tower Antonia, so called by Herod, in honor of Marcus Antonius. The temple resembled the citadel, and had its own walls, which were more laboriously constructed than the others. Even the colonnades with which it was surrounded formed an admirable outwork. It contained an inexhaustible spring. There were subterranean excavations in the hill, and tanks and cisterns for holding rainwater. The founders of the state had foreseen that frequent wars would result from the singularity of its customs, and so had made every provision against the most protracted siege. After the capture of their city by Pompey, experience and apprehension taught them much. Availing themselves of the sordid policy of the Claudian era to purchase the right of fortification, they raised, in time of peace, such walls as were suited for war. Their numbers were increased by a vast rabble collected from the overthrow of the other cities. All the most obstinate rebels had escaped into the place, and perpetual seditions were the consequence. There were 3 generals, and as many armies. Simon held the outer and larger circuit of walls. John, also called Barjoras, occupied the middle city. Eleazar had fortified the temple. John and Simon were strong in numbers and equipment, Eleazar in position. There were continual skirmishes, surprises, and incendiary fires, and a vast quantity of corn was burned. Before long, John sent some emissaries, who, under pretense of sacrificing, slaughtered Eleazar and his partisans, and gained possession of the temple. The city was thus divided between 2 factions, till, as the Romans approached, war with the foreigner brought about a reconciliation. End of Book 5, Part 1. Book 5, Part 2. Of the Histories by Publius Cornelius Tacitus. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Leni. The Histories by Publius Cornelius Tacitus, translated by Alfred John Church and William Jackson Brodribb. Book 5, January to November A.D. 70, Part 2. Prodigies had occurred, which this nation, prone to superstition but hating all religious rites, did not deem it lawful to expiate by offering and sacrifice. There had been seen hosts joining battle in the skies, the fiery gleam of arms, the temple illuminated by a sudden radiance from the clouds. The doors of the inner shrine were suddenly thrown open, and a voice of more than mortal tone was heard to cry that the gods were departing. At the same instant there was a mighty stir as of departure. Some few put a fearful meaning on these events, but in most there was a firm persuasion that in the ancient records of their priests was contained a prediction of how, at this very time, the East was to grow powerful, and rulers, coming from Judea, were to acquire universal empire. These mysterious prophecies had pointed to Vespasian and Titus, but the common people, with the usual blindness of ambition, had interpreted these mighty destinies of themselves, and could not be brought even by disasters to believe the truth. I have heard that the total number of the besieged, of every age and both sexes, amounted to 600,000. All who were able bore arms, and a number, more than proportionate to the population, had the courage to do so. Men and women showed equal resolution, and life seemed more terrible than death if they were to be forced to leave their country. Such was this city and nation. And Titus Caesar, seeing that the position forbade an assault or any of the more rapid operations of war, determined to proceed by earthworks and covered approaches. The legions had their respective duties assigned to them, and there was a cessation from fighting till all the inventions used in ancient warfare or devised by modern ingenuity for the reduction of cities were constructed. Meanwhile, Civilis, having recruited his army from Germany after his defeat among the Treveri, took up his position at the old camp, where his situation would protect him, and where the courage of his barbarian troops would be raised by the recollection of successes gained on the spot. He was followed to this place by Cerealis, whose forces had now been doubled by the arrival of the 2nd, 6th, and 14th legions. The auxiliary infantry and cavalry, summoned long before, had hastened to join him after his victory. Neither of the generals loved delay, but a wide extent of plain naturally saturated with water kept them apart. Civilis had also thrown a dam obliquely across the Rhine, so that the stream, diverted by the obstacle, might overflow the adjacent country. Such was the character of the district, full of hidden perils from the varying depth of the fords, and unfavorable to our troops. The Roman soldier is heavily armed and afraid to swim, while the German, who is accustomed to rivers, is favored by the lightness of his equipment and the height of his stature. The Batavi provoking a conflict, the struggle was at once begun by all the boldest spirits among our troops, but a panic arose when they saw arms and horses swallowed up in the vast depths of the marshes. The Germans leapt lightly through the well-known shallows, and frequently quitting the front, hung on the rear and flanks of our army. It was neither the close nor the distant fighting of a land battle. It was more like a naval contest. Struggling among the waters, or exerting every limb where they found any firm footing, the wounded and the unhurt, those who could swim and those who could not, were involved in one common destruction. The loss, however, was less than might have been expected from the confusion, for the Germans, not venturing to leave the moors, returned to the camp. The result of this battle roused both generals, though from different motives, to hasten on the final struggle. Civilis was anxious to follow up his success, Cerealis to wipe out his disgrace. The Germans were flushed with success, the Romans were thoroughly roused by shame. The barbarians spent the night in singing and shouting, our men in rage and threats of vengeance. Next morning, Cerealis formed his front with the cavalry and auxiliary infantry. In the second line were posted the legions, the general reserving a picked force for unforeseen contingencies. Civilis confronted him with his troops ranged, not in line, but in columns. On the right were the Batavi and the Gugerni. The left, which was nearer the river, was occupied by the Transrhenan tribes. The exhortations of the generals were not addressed as formal harangues to the assembled armies, but to the divisions separately as they rode along the line. Cerealis spoke of the old glory of the Roman name, of former and of recent victories. He told them that in destroying forever their treacherous, cowardly, and beaten foe, they had to execute a punishment rather than to fight a battle. They had lately contended with a superior force, and yet the Germans, the strength of the hostile army, had been routed. A few were left, who carried terror in their hearts and scars upon their backs. He addressed to the several legions appropriate appeals. The 14th were styled the conquerors of Britain. The powerful influence of the 6th had made Galba emperor. The men of the 2nd were in that battle first to consecrate their new standards and new eagle. Then, riding up to the army of Germany, he stretched forth his hand and implored them to recover their river bank and their camp by the slaughter of the foe. A joyful shout arose from the whole army, some of whom, after long peace, lusted for battle, while others, weary of war, desired peace. All were looking for rewards and for future repose. Nor did Civilis marshal his army in silence. He called the field of battle to bear witness to their valor. He told the Germans and Batavians that they were standing on the monuments of their glory, that they were treading underfoot the ashes and bones of legions. Wherever, he said, the Roman turns his eye, captivity, disaster, and everything that is terrible will confront him. Do not be alarmed by the adverse result of the battle among the Treveri. There, their own success proved hurtful to the Germans, for, throwing away their arms, they hampered their hands with plunder. Since then, everything has been favorable to us and against the foe. All precautions which the skill of a general should take have been taken. Here are these flooded plains which we know so well, here the marshes so fatal to the enemy. The Rhine and the gods of Germany are in your side. Under their auspices, give battle, remembering your wives, your parents, and your fatherland. This day will either be the most glorious among the deeds of the past, or will be infamous in the eyes of posterity. These words were hailed, according to their custom, with the clash of arms and with wild antics, and then the battle was commenced by a discharge of stones, leaden balls, and other missiles. Our soldiers not entering the morass, while the Germans sought to provoke, and so draw them on. When their store of missiles was spent, and the battle grew hotter, a fiercer onslaught was made by the enemy. Their tall stature and very long spears enabled them, without closing, to wound our men, who were wavering and unsteady. At the same time, a column of the Bructeri swam across from the dam, which I have described as carried out into the river. Here there was some confusion. The line of the allied infantry was being driven back when the legions took up the contest. The fury of the enemy was checked, and the battle again became equal. At the same time, a Batavian deserter came up to Cerealis, offering an opportunity of attacking the enemy's rear if some cavalry were sent along the edge of the morass. The ground there was firm, and the Gugerni, to whom the post had been allotted, were careless. Two squadrons were sent with the deserter and outflanked the unsuspecting enemy. At the shout that announced the success, the legions charged in front. The Germans were routed and fled towards the Rhine. The war would have been finished that day if the fleet had hastened to come up. As it was, the cavalry did not pursue, for a storm of rain suddenly fell and night was at hand. The next day, the 14th Legion was sent into the upper province to join Gallus Annius. The 10th, which had arrived from Spain, supplied its place in the army of Cerealis. Civilis was joined by some auxiliaries from the Chauci. Nevertheless, he did not venture to fight for the defense of the Batavian capital, but carrying off property that could be removed, and setting fire to the remainder, he retreated into the island, aware that there were not vessels enough for constructing a bridge, and that the Roman army could not cross the river in any other way. He also demolished the dike constructed by Drusus Germanicus, and by destroying this barrier, sent the river flowing down a steep channel on the side of Gaul. The river having been thus, so to speak, diverted, the narrowness of the channel between the island and Germany created an appearance of an uninterrupted surface of dry ground. Tutor, Classicus, and 113 senators of the Treveri also crossed the Rhine. Among them was Alpinius Montanus, of whose mission into Gaul by Antonius I have already spoken. He was accompanied by his brother, Decimus Alpinius. His other adherents were now endeavoring to collect auxiliaries among these danger-loving tribes by appeals to their pity and their greed. The war was so far from being at an end that Civilis, in one day, attacked on 4 points the positions of the auxiliary infantry and cavalry and of the legions, assailing the 10th Legion at Erenacum, the 2nd at Batavodurum, and the camp of the auxiliary infantry and cavalry at Grine and Vada, and so dividing his forces, that he himself, his sister's son Verax, Classicus and Tutor, led each his own division. They were not confident of accomplishing all these objects, but they hoped that, if they made many ventures, fortune would favor them on some point. Besides, Cerealis was not cautious, and might easily be intercepted, as the multiplicity of tidings hurried him from place to place. The force, which had to attack the 10th Legion, thinking it a hard matter to storm a legionary encampment, surprised some troops who had gone out, and were busy felling timber, killed the prefect of the camp, 5 centurions of the first rank, and a few soldiers. The rest found shelter behind the fortifications. At Batavodurum, the German troops tried to break down the bridge partly built. Night terminated an indecisive conflict. There was great danger at Grins and Vada. Civilis attacked Vada, Classicus, Grins, and they could not be checked, for our bravest men had fallen, among them Briganticus, who commanded a squadron of cavalry, and of whose loyalty to the Roman cause and enmity to his uncle Civilis I have already spoken. But when Cerialis came up with a picked body of cavalry, the fortune of the day changed, and the Germans were driven headlong into the river. Civilis, who was recognized while seeking to stop his flying troops, became the mark of many missiles, left his horse, and swam across the river. Verax escaped in the same way. Some light vessels were brought up and carried off Tutor and Classicus. Even on this occasion, the Roman fleet was not present at the engagement, though orders had been given to that effect. Fear kept them away, and their crews were dispersed about other military duties. Cerialis, in fact, allowed too little time for executing his commands. He was hasting his plans, though eminently successful in their results. Fortune helped him, even where skill had failed, and so both the general and his army became less careful about discipline. A few days after this, he escaped the peril of actual capture, but not without great disgrace. He had gone to Novesium and Bona to inspect the camps which were then in course of erection for the winter abode of the legions, and was making his way back with the fleet, his escort being in disorder and his sentries negligent. This was observed by the Germans, and they planned a surprise. They chose a dark and cloudy night, and moving rapidly down the stream, entered the entrenchments without opposition. The carnage was at first helped on by a cunning device. They cut the ropes of the tents, and slaughtered the soldiers as they lay buried beneath their own dwellings. Another force put the fleet into confusion, threw their grappling irons on the vessels, and dragged them away by the sterns. They sought at first to elude notice by silence, but when the slaughter was begun, by way of increasing the panic, they raised on all sides a deafening shout. The Romans, awakened by sounds, looked for their arms and rushed through the passages of the camp, some few with their proper accoutrements, but most with their garments wrapped round their shoulders and with drawn swords in their hands. The general, who was half asleep and all but naked, was saved by the enemy's mistake. They carried off the Praetorian vessel, which was distinguished by a flag, believing that the general was on board. Cerialis indeed had passed the night elsewhere, in the company, as many believed, of an Ubian woman, Claudia Sacrata. The sentinels sought to excuse their own scandalous neglect by the disgraceful conduct of the general, alleging that they had been ordered to be silent, that they might not disturb his rest, and that, from omitting the watchwords and the usual challenges, they had themselves fallen asleep. The enemy rode back in broad daylight with the captured vessels. The Praetorian trireme they towed up the river Lupia as a present to Veleda. Civilis was seized by a desire to make a naval demonstration. He manned all the triremes that he had, and such vessels as were propelled by a single bank of oars. To these he added a vast number of boats. He put in each 300 or 400 men, the usual complement of a Liburnian galley. With these were the captured vessels, in which, picturesquely enough, plaids of various colors were used for sails. The place selected was an expanse of water, not unlike the sea, where the mouth of the Mosa serves to discharge the Rhine into the ocean. The motive for equipping this fleet was, to say nothing of the natural vanity of this people, a desire to intercept, by this alarming demonstration, the supplies that were approaching from Gaul. Cerialis, more in astonishment than alarm, threw up his fleet in line, and though inferior in numbers, it had the advantage in the experience of the crews, the skill of the pilots, and the size of the vessels. The Romans had a stream with them. The enemy's vessels were propelled by the wind. Thus passing each other, they separated after a brief discharge of light missiles. Civilis attempted nothing more, and retired to the other side of the Rhine. Cerialis mercilessly ravaged the island of the Batavi, but, with a policy familiar to commanders, left untouched the estates and houses of Civilis. Meanwhile, however, the autumn was far advanced, and the river, swollen by the continual rains of the season, overflowed the island, marshy and low-lying as it is, till it resembled a lake. There were no ships, no provisions at hand, and the camp, which was situated on a low ground, was in process of being carried away by the force of the stream. That the legions might then have been crushed, and that the Germans wished to crush them, but were turned from their purpose by his own craft, was claimed as a merit by Civilis. Nor is it unlike the truth, since a capitulation followed in a few days. Cerialis, sending secret emissaries, had held out the prospect of peace to the Batavi, and of pardon to Civilis, while he advised Veleda and her relatives to change by a well-timed service to the Roman people the fortune of war, which so many disasters had shown to be adverse. He reminded them that the Treveri had been beaten, that the Ubii had submitted, that the Batavi had had their country taken from them, and that from the friendship of Civilis nothing else had been gained but wounds, defeat, and mourning. An exile and a fugitive, he could only be a burden to those who entertained him, and they had already trespassed enough in crossing the Rhine so often. If they attempted anything more, on their side would be the wrong and the guilt, with the Romans the vengeance of heaven. Thus promises were mingled with threats. When the fidelity of the Transrhenan tribes had been thus shaken, among the Batavi also there arose debates. "We can no longer," they said, "postpone our ruin. The servitude of the whole world cannot be averted by a single nation. What has been accomplished by destroying legions with fire and sword, but that more legions and stronger have been brought up? If it was for Vespasian that we fought this war, then Vespasian rules the world. If we meant to challenge to battle the Roman people, then what a mere fraction of the human race are the Batavi. Look at the Rhetians and Noricans, and the burdens borne by the other allies. No tribute, but valor and manhood are demanded of us. This is the next thing to liberty, and if we must choose between masters, then we may more honorably bear with the emperors of Rome than with the women of the Germans." Such were the murmurs of the lower class. The nobles spoke in fiercer language. "We have been driven into war," they said, "by the fury of Civilis. He sought to counterbalance his private wrongs by the destruction of his nation. Then were the gods angry with the Batavi when the legions were besieged, when the legates were slain, when the war, so necessary to that one man, so fatal to us, was begun. We are at the last extremity, unless we think of repenting, and avow our repentance by punishing the guilty." These dispositions did not escape the notice of Civilis. He determined to anticipate them, moved not only by weariness of his sufferings, but also by that clinging to life which often breaks the noblest spirits. He asked for a conference. The bridge over the river Nabalia was cut down, and the two generals advanced to the broken extremities. Civilis thus opened the conference. "If it were before a legate of Vitellius that I were defending myself, my acts would deserve no pardon, my words no credit. All the relations between us were those of hatred and hostility, first made so by him, and afterwards embittered by me. My respect for Vespasian is of long standing. While he was still a subject, we were called friends. This was known to Primus Antonius, whose letters urged me to take up arms, for he feared lest the legions of Germany and the youth of Gaul should cross the Alps. What Antonius advised by his letters, Hordionius suggested by word of mouth. I fought the same battle in Germany, as did Messianus in Syria, Aponius in Moesia, Flavianus in Pannonia." At this point, the histories break off. We do not know what happened to Civilis. The Batavians seem to have received favorable treatment. End of Book 2, Part 5. End of Tacitus' Histories, translated by Alfred John Church and William Jackson Brodribb.